Hello, and welcome. It's June 2nd, 2016, and this is Radio Free Nintendo episode 479, and we are going to kill Dracula. I was going to do this introduction in Japanese, but I didn't have time to write it all out and make sure I could pronounce it correctly. I'm sorry.
You should have done the German bit for Langerscheid.
It sounds like the same thing.
It is my understanding that the German is not super great.
I guess that's true.
I wanted to do it in my Dracula voice. We'll get to it. Hello, Greg.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
John Lindemann, give me your best German.
Griechen Splocken de Bricken de Vrocken?
You are a testament to your lineage, sir.
Thank you.
Guillaume.
Yes?
Give me your best French-Canadian-Japanese Dracula.
Arigato gozaimasu. Sorry, no, that was the shopkeeper from Seventh Dragon. I'm sorry.
Yes. It is, in fact, the Seventh Dragon shopkeeper, because, Guillaume, you and I are both playing Seventh Dragon 3 Code VFD, provided to us by our friends at Sega.
Indeed. Yeah, so this is interesting. First, I'm really glad that I got the copy for free, but I was probably going to get it as soon as it released, because this game has, for me, kind of a weird hype to it, because it's the fourth in a series. There were two PSP games, and it all started with a DS game by former team members, like the creator of Etrian Odyssey. So yeah, it was a DS game, and it never left Japan. And now on the fourth iteration, we're getting it. And I can understand why some people would be like, well, I would rather start with the beginning, but it's a good place to start, because like it doesn't feel so far that I've missed anything, that I'm that there's lore that I'm missing or whatever. So
They do a good job bringing you into it, because so the first game actually takes place in I think in the world that you experience later in the game. Like they spend a lot of time recapping stuff that happened in the previous games, because ultimately the characters that you're playing as are also learning about this stuff too. So it doesn't really matter that you haven't played these games.
Yeah, and it's got like this cute intro where it's kind of the Last Starfighter kind of deal, where you're in Tokyo in the year 2070 something. And this company called Nodens, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but
I'm going with Nodens.
Nodens, who the font that they use, their corporate font, is strangely Nintendo-like, in my opinion. But they're like some sort of VR game company, and they've got like the biggest hit. It's a virtual game where you slay dragons and stuff. And it turns out that yes, they built this entire thing and made billions of dollars only to really like find like the best dragon hunters, and that turns out to be you. And so they recruit you to go kill some actual factual dragons. And from there,
a lot of actual factual dragons.
Yeah, a whole bunch of them. So as I said, some people with a background with Etrian Odyssey started this series. I'm not sure about this particular game. It's made by Sega, but I'm not sure. Like, it's still got the same producer, Rieko.
Oh, Rieko Kodama?
Right, yeah. So, yeah, she was, you know, she's the producer in this, and she was, she's been involved since the beginning of the series, and she's got a long history with Phantasy Star and all that stuff. But, anyway, so as I said, there's like Etrian Odyssey DNA here. So you don't have a first-person view. You are dungeon crawling, but the focus really isn't on the dungeons. The dungeons are very, very simple, and there's you run around and you get into random encounters. But the main goal is to rid the world of dragons, and you see a counter. It's kind of like Metroid 2 that way. There's a counter that, you know, every time you kill a dragon, it goes down, and there's like over 400 of them. And the dragons you actually see on the map. And so, and they can, kind of like in Etrian Odyssey, the FOEs, when you are you know, smacking around a bunch of, you know, a random encounter, like some low-level enemies, if there's a dragon nearby, they can butt in and just attack you, like get inside the combat and start fighting you.
It is almost exactly like FOEs, cause even yeah. with the, like, hey, you've got basically four turns to, like, get in here. You've got three turns.
Right.
And sometimes you're fighting one and another one shows up, which is a whole barrel of fun.
Well, it can be, actually. So, some of the most fun that I've had with the game so far was like, oh, shit, like a second dragon is wants to have a piece of me. And
oh, hey, sup.
But, yeah, so... The regular fodder, kind of like in the Etrian Odyssey game, can be a little bit annoying because it seems to me that most, at least in my party, the party that I built, all the attacks seem to be kind of setting up traps and kind of for long-term mm-hmm. damage, you know? Like for a long time, you're kind of just setting things up, and then all of a sudden, everything hits at the same time and kills a dragon in one shot, and it's immensely satisfying. But it makes the regular fodder a little bit annoying because they can injure you more than you'd like, and you've got limited healing in dungeons, and they're not one shot kills, so they can be a little bit annoying. But as soon as you fight a dragon, that's where, like, the real fun starts.
Yeah, I did want to talk about the classes a little bit, because you sort of touched on it.
Yes.
There's a pretty sizable number of classes, just well, like Etrian games.
Yeah, well, there's eight in total. But you start with four.
Yeah, there's
not that many, but they all have kind of dual roles. But
right.
Carry on.
But there's a lot of them that are, as you say, they're dedicated to setups. So mm-hmm. I have one that she uses twin guns, and in general she does not hit especially hard.
Yeah, the agent.
But she has she has two skills, one that are really imperative to what she does. One is she can fire off a shot on one turn and then it hits for the next three turns, dealing about 50% more damage than her normal special attack does. That she can continue to do her normal special attack on top of that. But
right.
She also has another skill called Hack, where if she inflicts the status effect on the enemy called Hacked, and then she has a bunch of skills that will impact hacked enemies, like make them fight each other, steal health from them, steal
mana.
LP or something like that.
Right.
But similarly, there's the character, I think it's called like the Brawler, the one that just punches.
Oh, the God Hand.
God Hand, yeah. Who inflicts a status called God, which is an interesting status. The translation here is pretty direct.
Yeah.
And a lot of her moves are dependent on a God level being on this enemy, and as you inflict God, the level goes up, like 1, 2, 3, etc. And each skill will push it. Either push it or up or down, and essentially, if you get it up to three, she has a skill that she can use that just is devastating, and the god level never goes down as long as you keep firing it off. So there's a bunch of setup, like a three-turn setup, to get her there,
mm-hmm.
and then she's a boss-destroying machine.
Yeah,
so there's a lot of this, like, managing these classes, whereas your other classes just hit hard, and that's what they do, and they do the same thing every turn.
Well,
start.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I think there's several ways to use each of them. Like, my party is the God Hand, so deals a lot of physical damage, inflicts the God Hand thing, the God thing, and from there can do debuffs on the enemy. And also, he's kind of my healer. I've got
heals as well. Yes.
Right. So I've got the Duelist, who's kind of the magic user, but she's got a deck of cards. And she mm-hmm. starts each battle with a certain number of cards, and she uses those cards to battle. So it's not an entire kind of card-based RPG combat system here. It's very, very basic. She's got like...
There's only three cards.
Yeah, blue, yellow, and red. But then you use them to trigger, well, to cast spells, you know, fire, ice, or lightning. Or you can set up traps, and those can be so much fun because you set up a trap and then kind of like barbed wire. And so every time that the enemy hits you physically, the barbed wire has a chance, deals damage and has a chance to make the enemy bleed every turn. So there's a lot of these spells and attacks have these status effects that they can inflict. You know, if you cast a fire spell, not only you're going to deal fire damage, but you're also probably going to burn the enemy, and then they're going to get damage every action they take. You know, ice can also do the same thing. They can slow down the enemy, I think, and lightning can shock, so they get paralyzed. So you can play a lot with that. She's my favorite so far, the duelist, because you set up all three traps, and then she's got this special thing where she kind of lets go of all her traps and deals massive damage against the enemy. And I've had it sometimes where, you know, like I'm fighting, I'm almost dead, you know, from fighting one dragon, and then I don't quite manage to eliminate it before another one shows up. But I've managed to set down the last trap of the three just in time. And I kill first dragon, and then the trap closes in on the second dragon, and it's a one-hit kill, and it can be so satisfying. I'm really enjoying setting up, like, kind of combos in this game, and it's something that you can kind of do in Etrian Odyssey games, but Etrian Odyssey
not
games
like
never, yeah, not like this. Like, they never really made me feel all that badass, you know? Etrian Odyssey, you kind of fight for every little single hit point that you inflict, you know, of damage. And sure, like, you can have, you know, certain classes that will follow up each of your party's hits with their hits of their own, or they're going to imbue attacks with magic and stuff like that. But it's never that devastating. Whereas here, you can really, like, set it up so that while your duelist is setting up her traps, you're keeping her safe by drawing the aggro elsewhere, you know, with your gut hand being in a kind of defensive stance. And then, you know, like, you heal both of them with your third character, maybe. And it can just, like, the strategy can really, really pay off. And it's just immensely satisfying.
Well, and the strategy goes into how you develop your characters, too. Because independent of the experience, there's the second set of experience that you get, SP, which you use to buy skills.
Mm-hmm.
For these classes. So I've the Fortuner is in my B party. So you have two parties. It looks like there's probably a third based on how the screen is laid out. And they gain experience together, and you can swap them in the dungeon at any time. You can swap members, you can swap the whole party.
Mm-hmm.
And during battle, essentially a clock is ticking down, and as it hits certain points, the second string can jump into the fight and deal damage or heal or change status effects.
Right.
The Fortuner has a bunch of incredibly hard-hitting skills that inflict either sleep, bleed, blind, or poison. And then if it inflicts those, they have these skills called the Oracle of Power or the Oracle of Spirit that deals even more damage to people affected by those status effects.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like this super broken class that it carried the B party along when it was 10 levels too low on its own, like on its back. And then I realized I didn't need to do that, and I could have the A party up and they still would have gotten their experience. But like, I like playing with these classes, and I'm eager to get more slots so I can throw the ones I don't have out there. Because right now, everybody's so strong, like, I don't want to swap somebody out. Because they're, like, we're manhandling even bosses at this point. So it's like, I really want to get the next set out there just so I can see those classes, too.
Yeah, so I'm at that point personally. And yeah, like, at certain story points, you can add people to your team. And yeah, like, that's it's so great that you can just level them up all at the same time, you know, like, and the new members that you add later in the game, they do start at level one, but the last group that I have, my third team, they went from level one to level 17 in one dragon fight, you know?
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah. So they caught up really, really quickly. And, it's so great. Like the game does a lot of things like that where it's like, well, of course, you know, you don't want your unused party people, the unused people in your party to kind of, linger and not really get any experience, because then you're really never gonna use them. And if at some point the story forces you to use them, you're gonna be screwed. So it's just, it's well done. And that, kind of goes also for the quests, because I was, you know, we played the Xenoblade Chronicles X recently. In this game, the side quests are actually kind of explained to you in every detail, you know.
Excruciating detail. Like, you need to go talk to this person.
Yeah, they're really not complicated, you know. But yeah, they do tell you, you need to go talk to this person. They're located here. Okay, now you go, you know, to this other place. And now you go back to the first person. And you can just, like, go back in your menu and look and, you know, for a reminder. Oh, yeah, like, that person's over there. Yeah, yeah. So everything... That I guess you could see it as kind of a negative, you know, like the side quest. The dungeon design is very, very linear. It's more like Bravely Default that way, you know, like there's one, you came in from one place and you're going to the exit, you know, and that there's...
It's largely just hallways. Like, there's no branching paths. It's just like, go straight through the hallway. Occasionally you run into a barrier and you have to turn right.
Yeah. I mean, but the real star of the game. Yeah. But the real star of the game is fighting the dragons, and I can't say I miss, like, having intricate mazes to explore. Just the fun of trying to sneak up behind a dragon to get a preemptive strike is fun, or trying to set it up so that, you know, you're going to attract one dragon during one random encounter and not, you know, three of them can be fun. So yeah, I'm really enjoying the game. And, there's a few things that irritate, because just like in Etrian Odyssey, the art style can be a little bit fan servicey, but unlike Etrian Odyssey, the character design is not lottie, like it's not, they don't look like children, which is a huge...
Well, except for the children.
Yeah, except for the children, but the children don't, I don't know, the models that I've seen, like the portraits that I've seen didn't seem sexualized, whereas in, Etrian Odyssey, you'll have like the sexy blacksmith who looks like, you know, a toddler, and it's like, what are you doing? You know?
12. Looks like 12. Let's not go toddler. Let's not be ridiculous.
Yeah, come on.
Yeah, okay.
It's funny actually how much, especially with the party, the game sort of borrows here, because you essentially just create people out of ether, pick a portrait. And there's a couple different styles of each portrait. Throw a class on them, give them a name, assign a voice, and now they're in the party, which is very similar to what Etrian does.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just sort of stat up. You know, they're non-entities. In fact,
yeah,
the only person who ever gets talked to directly by the NPCs is the leader of the party. Mm-hmm. And if you switch the lead party, they'll address whoever is the leader of the party as if the two people are the same person. Which is funny to do it like mid conversation, like you'll talk and you have to talk to him again, and they'll be like, "I'm so glad you're here, person one." And then when you flip it, if you weren't here, person two, we would have never succeeded. And I'm like, "No, because the other dude was here and he did all the work."
Yeah, it's like, better. It's better not to overthink it, you know. Like, I think
just a funny quirk.
Yeah, I think if people weren't too put off by the blank slate character in, like, Dragon Quest IX or in a Etrian Odyssey game, like, they're probably not going to mind it here. The stuff that I do mind a little bit more, other than some of the character design where the women have breasts that are kind of, like, huge and lemon-shaped somehow and gravity-defying.
Anime is happening, Gil.
Yeah, sure, but I don't know. It's not even... It doesn't make sense.
Anime is happening.
Yeah.
Beyond that,
there's also the localization, which, to me...
Is weird!
It is weird. To me, and I don't say that as someone who's seen a lot of them, but I've seen a few, enough to know that, okay, that's what it looks like. Fan subs of anime where, like, specifically, like, stuff like Naruto... where it's aimed for children, but everyone is fucking swearing all the time, you know?
Right.
When they really don't need to.
Well, and they may actually be swearing in the Japanese. Like, it's not necessarily as big a deal.
Right, right.
But it does sometimes come off weird when they're, like, swearing. So your navigator character is this, like, stuffed rabbit thing in a top hat.
Mm-hmm.
And is just a mean-spirited... asshole. And just like constantly belittling and just swearing at you and just like telling you to get the hell out of bed, goddammit. It's just like, what?
Yeah, what is and with using this character? The words goddammit, calling you shithead and stuff like that, you know?
It's weird. It's a weird thing. I mean, it's not surprising that Sega Atlas would be okay with that kind of stuff in the game. It's just sometimes you're like,
it's just a footing.
This game's kind of whimsical, but this guy's a fuck.
Right.
But at the same time, you have characters like your boss, who is both
just
of your bosses
constantly. Yeah, they're constantly sexually harassing you. Like they're always making comments. Like the boss of the company gives you unasked for massage. And
it's a face massage. It's okay.
And the lead programmer in this company just constantly talks about like, oh, like you could find another way to pay me and stuff like that, you know? And it's just like, dude, back off.
I love these pure white sheep.
Yeah. And at some point it's funny because,
oh, it's always funny. It's always funny because it's like you put the, like my second party has one of the kids as its leader.
Oh God.
And like,
no.
it's super like, what are you doing, game?
Yeah, yeah. And what's, you know, like one of the things that you can do in the game is that when you kill dragons, you earn a currency called DZ. DZ.
Yep.
Anyway, Diz. I don't know.
Dragon's Denny, I think is what they said it stands for.
Oh, okay. And so you use that to upgrade the company, Nodens. And so I've added crazy floors, like you know, a cat cafe and stuff like that. And funnily enough, no HR department yet.
No, but you do at the Sky Lounge. Have you been to the Sky Lounge, Guillaume?
Yeah, and that is also a weird thing where it's kind of like they tried to give the game some sort of social, kind of like something that's akin to the Social Links and Persona games or, you know, like kind of the character moments in Fire Emblem. But because none of the characters are characters, it's just, you go to the Sky Lounge with them and they'll say something like, oh, like I'm really happy you're around. Or one of them, like one of the guys in my team was like, I hope you're not going to leave me alone tonight. And it's just like, whoa, where did that come from?
I always thought it was kind of a parody of those things because when you go to the screen, it's like, who do you want to talk to? And you say, I want to pick somebody on my team.
Right.
Like they just seem to have random hearts. Like everybody on the A team is like, one heart away from a full bar, but that's not changed in like the last 10 hours. And then everybody on the B team only has one heart for everybody on the A team, except for the leader who is like super infatuated with the leader of the A team. Huh. But it's like the two character models is basically, it's the adult and child of what looks like the same person, which is weird. And so when I said, well, what happens if I put these two out there? The child character sits down next to the adult and goes, I'm glad you're with me right now. And this is like, this is weird. He's like hitting on his older clone. What's happening? This is unpleasant and I'm not happy about it.
Yeah, it didn't really bother.
I wonder if the whole thing is just kind of like an elaborate joke. Cause there's definitely some things here that are kind of like, yep, this is an RPG game, isn't it, guys? Like a little wink and a nod stuff. And I'm wondering if maybe that whole floor is that.
Yeah, I guess. I guess maybe it could be a parody because there is a side quest where you do kind of kill like this many enemies to get like 10 horns of something. And it's the one quest like that. And then you go back and new quests appear and you talk to the quest giver guy and he's just like, okay, well, I don't know what you guys can do to help us, but there's about like 100 quests where we need you to gather like 50 of, you know, these ingredients. And he's like, well, okay, no, I'm just joking. But, you know, like I was generally scared for a moment there because I was like, oh no, like I just played Xenoblade Chronicles X, please. And then the game is just like, yeah, no, you're not going to have to do that again.
Instead, you go back and forth delivering love letters to your boss from a soldier.
Yeah, very, very simple side quests, but
the game has a built-in warp, so that's actually really convenient.
Yeah.
That mysteriously doesn't work in some places, and I can't figure out why. But, Guillaume, you seem to be having a good time with it. You enjoy the Etrian games, so there's definitely some Etrian lineage here.
Yeah, and I think that, like, this is more approachable. Like, it's more...
Oh, it's totally more approachable.
Yeah, and it's got... It's kind of like a Bravely Default game in that you're playing with different classes and different abilities and combining them and trying to find something that's especially effective. But yep. I think that this game has better pacing so far than the Bravely Default game. There's less...
I mean, it's much less of a presentation. Yeah. And so Bravely Default spends a lot of time sort of getting you through the presentation, taking you through these big production scenes and showing off this world it's built. This game's like, hey, you want to go to Tokyo Underground? It's a straight line. What'd you expect? It's a subway line. Come on. Go rescue some cats.
Yep.
Like this game is much less about giving you a tour through this storybook they've built. It's much more about, like, let's get you back into battle so you can go kill some dragons.
There's one thing I don't understand, though. Like, the at the beginning of the game, as I said, it starts out as this virtual reality thing, but quickly you end up fighting in the real world. So how exactly do you hack the enemies? It's never really explained, you know?
I don't know.
Why does the duelist use cards to cast her spells and stuff? It makes sense in the simulation, but...
She's a huge fan of Baten Kaitos.
I see. Well, who isn't?
No friend of mine. Craig.
Yes.
What have you been playing?
I have a very natural follow-up because it involves a dragon and mazes. It's almost exactly the same game, to be honest.
Oh, okay, good.
It's Devil World from 1984, the year I was born.
It's too hot for North America.
Yeah, so did you import a Famicom copy or what?
No. So this has been on PAL Virtual Consoles going back to the Wii. To be honest, this is one case where I think you could be kind of grateful for NES Virtual Console being on 3DS, even though it's not the best presentation of those games in some cases, you know, especially depending on which model you've got. I don't know how well it's suited to a smaller screen, the kind of the action and stuff. John's problems with Super Mario Bros. 3 are a well traveled subject.
I make no apologies.
But, you know, something like Devil World is the kind of thing that I would never have bought on the Virtual Console for Wii. Because it's essentially a Pac-Man clone type of deal. It's a maze game, as I said, with this little dragon called Tamagon. That Nintendo made a long time ago, as I said, 1984, which puts it sort of early Famicom, but not quite launch. It was a bit after that, but of course it never became part of American launch because they didn't. You know, it does, for whatever reason, have all this sort of iconography in it. The game revolves around you picking up crosses at first. You've got basically action split up into three different kinds of stages, and then once you have a round of three, you go to another round where, you know, the maze will be a bit more complicated, and you keep going through rounds and the mazes change and the game starts to speed up, and, you know, it's a high score game. And that's the kind of game that, you know, I said, quick bursts on a portable, you know, come back to it every now and again, trying to beat your score. Yeah, I quite like that kind of thing. You know, I've got pinball games on my 3DS and all that kind of stuff, like Kirby's Pinball Land. Haven't got Revenge of the Gate yet. I really should do that, considering it's, you know, from the same people. But, you know, that kind of stuff is... I've had Marvel Zen Pinball, you know, on. I talked about that once upon a time. It's just the portable format's great for these sorts of games. And it's... you know, that's the kind of game it is, and it's a sort of interesting historical curiosity given that it didn't make it to America. It did come out early in PAL territories, but I think it must have pretty much sank without a trace. You know, I didn't know that this game existed when I was growing up, and we had an NES very early, you know, relative to when it came out here, like the 87. So, you know, I don't know what that was.
Was it Pac-Man related games or games of similar ilk were a dime a dozen on the NES as well?
Also, I guess the thing is with the fact they did bring it to Europe, like I said, at that point you're talking about 87, And right. that kind of game's a lot more passe, you know, than it was in 84.
That's an 85 game.
You know, and of course they had, you know, all the games they knew had been really big in America. Super Mario Brothers and to some extent Duck Hunt and all that kind of stuff. So they tried to push it in the same ways with the robot and with the Zapper and all that kind of stuff. So this, I guess, did come out in Europe, but like I said, I wasn't aware of it. But it is notable for being the first collaboration between Shigeru Miyamoto and Tezuka. Of course, would go on the next sort of two big projects on Famicom/NES would be somewhat more consequential. In the form of Super Mario Brothers and The Legend of Zelda. So, you know, this is kind of interesting to see them, taking something on before they make two of the most important games ever together. It tries to put its own kind of twist on that kind of maze game formula. So you've got, a lot of people be familiar with the devil character. From Smash Brothers, he's the assist trophy guy that comes out and shifts the screen in one direction or another. So where that goes back to in this case is that you're in a maze, you're much like a Pac-Man type of thing, but the devil's at the top of the screen sort of ordering his minions to move this border that's around the edge of the maze so that the screen will scroll in a particular direction. And basically what that can do is trap you between a wall and the border and kill you. You've got to think about, first of all, picking up crosses for some reason, which give you the ability to collect the dots in sort of very much Pac-Man fashion, but also to breathe fire to kill enemies. Once you've collected all the dots in the first stage of a round, you go to a second stage where now instead of collected dots that are in a fixed position within the maze, you're collecting Bibles again. I don't know why, which float above the maze in a fixed position on the screen. And so why this is kind of an interesting switch up on the first part of the round is that now, like I said, in the first part, especially if you're willing to be patient and wait for the devil to sort of force the screen in a kind of advantageous direction, you don't have to go too far to the edges to collect those dots if you don't want to. There isn't a timer forcing you to do it quickly. I mean, there are enemies and things. So, I guess the longer you stick around, the more likely you are to fall foul of them. But, you know, you could be patient. You could wait till it's, like, pretty safe to get them. And certainly it starts pretty slow. So it's like, you don't have to take too many chances. But then in the second part, they are now at the corners, whatever's going on with the scrolling. So you have to go to the corners to get them. And then that will function... That Bible will function as the cross did in the first stage, whereby it allows you to defeat enemies. But then you've got to take it back to the sort of the hub of the maze, which is this red block with a skull on it. Again, I don't know why this was needed. This occult flavor was needed. So you need to ultimately kind of give up your protection. And put it in the middle of the thing. So whereas in the first part, you've got all these dots to collect, but you've got like these whole crosses just strewn all over the place. They will run out after a while, but you're never that far away from them. So you can kind of, as long as you're careful, you can keep yourself protected most of the time. Here, the things you need to collect are your sources of protection. And of course, once you've like got three of them, there's only one of them left. It's all the way in the corner. So it gives you a few different things to think about. And then once you've done that bit, put all the four Bibles in the middle of this block, you get to a bonus round, is the third part, where now the devil's flown off in a huff. And the actual control of the scrolling of the screen is at your discretion. There's arrows on the screen, which you can walk over to trigger it in a particular direction. And you've got six boxes on the screen at once, again, sort of floating above them. So they're in a fixed position on the screen. And, in one of them will be an extra life. And of course, the rest of them is points. You want all of them, but the extra life is the one you want. And I guess that kind of brings me to one element of the game's design, which I feel is, it doesn't really make the game completely confounding or unenjoyable. But I think there probably is a bit more luck involved with this than would be ideal, if you know what I mean. It's in terms of how much. you know, what direction the devil's going to scroll it in a given moment. And like I said, with this, you know, you might... It's pretty difficult once the timer starts getting shorter on this bonus stage to get all the boxes. But, you know, one of them is going to have an extra life, so you might only get half of them, but you might keep getting extra lives like every time or something. So that would be, like, that would really help. Whereas on the other hand, you know, you might get 5 out of the 6 and not get the extra life. So it's just, you know, I guess it's got to be obviously a classic kind of, even though it was never intended for the arcade or anything like that, it's very much an arcade sensibility type of game. And luck will come into it to some extent. But there's plenty of skill as well. And discipline, I guess, is the most important thing with the game. In terms of, you know, there's times where it might be tempted to kind of, oh, I'll just go against the grain here, you know, against the direction it's scrolling, just to nip in there and collect those last few dots. But you shouldn't. You know, because if the, you know, you do get warning that he's about to change direction, the screen will stop scrolling and he'll start gesturing, start pointing in one direction, like, okay, it's gonna start scrolling sideways, you know, from right to left in 3, 2, 1 now. So, you know, but that's the, if it's been scrolling for a while, you can bet in one direction, you can bet a change is coming. So, you know, don't go in that tight space when it might change before you can get out. Like that's the, I mean, yes, you could have got in there and got lucky and it wouldn't have been a problem, but that's the luck element. But at the same time, you know, there's a bit of determinism in there too. You put yourself in there when you know it could have changed. So, you know, like I said, discipline, patience is pretty important. I do kind of wish that just, I mean, I haven't got like that far into it, but the top score I've got is like about 100,000, which is equivalent to get to like round 5. And I think the rounds go into the high teens before they essentially stop progressing and the game just kind of keeps going without getting faster and harder or whatever. You know, more enemies, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, from what I've seen so far, you know, definitely the biggest thing that happens with the maze designs is that parts of it become more enclosed, harder to get out of from a particular direction. So basically easier to screw yourself if you decide to go in there and nab something kind of quickly when, you know, it might not be safe to do that. So it's a weird kind of game. It lacks the flow, I think, of something like Pac-Man. You know, Pac-Man's got a more natural kind of smooth element to its gameplay, and it's kind of more cut and dry with just anticipating the behavior patterns of the ghosts and all that kind of stuff. But this, you know, I guess the point is, you know, because Pac-Man was already out there, you know, this was trying to put its own spin on it, and I do like it. It's nice just for to, you know, as a little micro play. So you because with the suspend feature as well, of course, yeah, you could just play a round and then come back to it another time. You know, it really is kind of good for that micro play stuff. If you know, during a commercial break, you're a sporting event or something, you know, you really can't be with it. You really can't abide being unentertained for that length of time, or you don't trust the corporate barons to keep you amused with their advertisements, then you just flip this open and have a go for a while. Like, so, you know, it's a fun sort of historical curiosity, and it is actually a fun little game. And some people think Tamagon is like a precursor to Yoshi because he comes out of an egg, and you know, Tezuka's involvement, he's the guy that handles everything Yoshi. They did talk about having Yoshi in the original Mario, supposedly. There were designs for him riding a dinosaur-y thing. There's like sketches that came out at some point. I don't know whether it was the 25th anniversary that this came out, about the fact they considered a Yoshi type of mount for him, even back then in 85, which would have been shortly after Devil World. But Tamagon actually looks more like Bub and Bob from Bubble.
Yeah, the same green, and I don't know, from the pictures, yeah, that's immediately the character that comes to mind.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I guess it's just like sound effects with the egg and all that kind of, the fire and all, they are pretty, that's basically presumably what Yoshi would have sounded like if they'd got to put it, but say for instance Mario Maker, if they'd put Yoshi into the 8-bit styles or something rather than Kuribo Shoe, I guess they could have just used these sound effects.
That would have been really cool if they said, hey, we had this thing we were thinking about, let's just use that.
Yeah, although I'm glad the shoe is like what they did with the shoe.
Oh, the shoe needs to be there because the shoe creates all kinds of nightmares. But yeah, you could have had both.
I guess you could have done, but just to bring us to the appropriateness, how this all fits together. Don't forget that Dracula means son of the dragon, so all this dragon stuff is just, it had to
there
be,
you go.
I guess, for this week.
Wow.
Yeah.
Destiny. It's a bitch.
Is that a tease for what you're going to be talking about this week, John?
Well, you know, I don't have a lot of our traditional new business, but I do have some new business. Speaking of Nintendo's E3 plans, we got some news on the E3.
Oh, you're
going to
go for it. Okay,
yeah,
let's
do it. I'll go for it. This is my contribution. Okay, so there was much wondering as to whether the only thing Nintendo would have at E3 this year, the only thing that they announced was, of course, the new Zelda for Wii U that would be shown. And so they announced this week the contents of their Treehouse. Since they're not going to have a Nintendo Direct E3 briefing, they mentioned their Treehouse schedule for their broadcasting. And it breaks down something like this. On June 14th, all right, at 9 a.m. PST, they're going to be going through Zelda for Wii U. Not the NX edition, though. Not that. Lord knows.
NX does not exist right now.
No,
please
no.
Check back. Please check back after we've added virtual reality and start building it in April.
If only we had some sort of sound effect that we could play.
We do not currently know what the NX is. We do not currently know what the NX is.
And they're going to have the first live gameplay demo for Pokemon Sun and Moon as well. And then on day two, they're going to have a developer Q&A for Pokemon Go, which I thought was kind of interesting. And then later in the day, they're going to have demos for various Wii U and 3DS games, including Monster Hunter Generations, Dragon Quest VII, and Tokyo Mirage Sessions. Hashtag FE, I guess.
Sharp FE.
Sharp
FE.
It's music.
My
it's
bad.
Music.
Yeah.
Music,
my bad. I'm on
plebeian.
Twitter. All the time, all right? So everything, anything is sharp.
You uncultured swine!
Even when I read sheet music, I'm like, what the fuck's up with all these hashtags? Jesus. So
hashtag
confusing. This is the worst Twitter
D.
feed ever. But, yeah. So, should be a little bit more interesting than people thought. So, yeah, they're going to do stuff other than just Zelda. So
it's just Zelda's the only thing that's going to be playable.
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. It's and of course you're still not talking about, you know, obviously I guess there's nothing that would absolutely prevent them from doing this, but I don't imagine it's going to involve announcing, you know, stuff that you haven't heard about at all. It seems like it's just, well, I mean, it would be silly, I think, for them not to do some of this stuff in terms of, especially for games I feel like Dragon Quest VII and Monster Hunter Generations, which, you know, could maybe, I think they are very significant games that are going to be coming out for 3DS
yep.
in the second half of the year, but they, you know, people's eyes are going to be on this because of Zelda and certainly Pokemon as well. It's huge. So why not, you know, while they're sort of in through the door, give your gin up interest and maybe help the sales of those games, which certainly have got, you know, strong pedigree. They've got, you know, pretty strong brands attached people know about, but maybe they need a bit of an extra nudge towards actually buying them. I think it would have been silly to pass on that. You know, so, I mean, this is certainly sensible. But
yeah,
I'm not getting my
well
hopes up
too.
For. Yeah, exactly. They've been going in this direction with Treehouse Live. People seem to like it. So, you know, I don't see why you totally scale that part of it back. I'm just not anticipating that it's going to substitute for the digital event, the pre-recorded
no.
kind of where, you know, they actually announce stuff that you haven't heard about anything about before. That part of it, you know, I can't imagine is we're going to be surprised by. But I mean, I suppose you never know. They might have some interesting things to talk about. Maybe like some of this DLC plan they kind of talk about. You know, they've talked about trying to squeeze some extra money out of Wii U games with DLC. Maybe they'll have things like that. So, I'm looking forward to seeing some of these games and in action. You know, I mean, I've said before, I've never played a Dragon Quest game, so it's not going to take much actually for me to say, yeah, this is the one. I'm finally going to do it with Seven. So, you know, if it looks good, that might be enough to seal the deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's coming out in the fall, right?
There's no, nothing concrete on that yet, other than they said 7 and 8 would both come out this year. They had said that. I'm not sure whether they'll be able
I've
to
heard
stick to that.
Things about that 8 version that might be the one.
Yeah, the 8 version was originally a PS2 game, so it's a bit more demanding, but, and I think also just relative to
Tales of the Abyss managed just fine though. So
sure, yeah, I'm not sure. Everybody speaks about that PS2 game though as probably like the best looking Dragon Quest, one of the best looking games on the system. You know, it sounds like it was quite a. You know, quite a sort of high bar to reach. So I don't know. And also, I just don't know what sort of resources went into the port. I mean, with 7, it seems like they really tried hard to kind of, you know, improve on some of the warts that were in the PS1 game. You know, whereas with 8, I think it was more just a kind of a recreation. So there's that angle to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it really makes me wonder what they're going to do. I mean, really how their directs are going to be laid out for the rest of the year. I mean, at some point, they're going to have to talk about NX. It's just a
sure,
question
and they,
of when.
And they will. They will. And
so
I think.
Like, what do you think? September?
I think. I'm of two minds. You know, I look at what they've got coming out this year, and it is pretty heavily leveraged. You know, we joke about the summer of too hot for games, but really it's the winter of too cold for games. In summer, we're actually going to do okay in terms of 3DS stuff.
Yep.
I think when that starts to kind of die down, you know, Sharp FE's coming out pretty soon after E3.
Yeah.
I think that's when we'll start to hear some more rumblings. I mean, really, now having heard the fullness of Nintendo's E3 plans, with the exception of stuff that they're going to be doing as a business, talking to people, they're really at E3 like the majority of publishers at this point. Like, they are there the same way that other people go to E3 that aren't, you know, the big three plus Ubisoft, EA, and for whatever reason, Bethesda. Like, that's it. Like, besides those people, everybody else does E3 the same way they're doing it now, essentially. And, I mean, you can look at it this way. Like, I think it was 2005 I saw today that 400-plus companies are registered for E3, and this year it's less than 200. Like, yeah. It's... E3 is a different thing than it was even when I went the last time 3 years ago. Or was it three? Mm-hmm. 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a different show, and it's not a big deal. You know, we talked about what could they announce NX in conjunction with back when we didn't realize this thing was coming out in March, or, well, next year. Because Siren of Noises don't know what NX is.
We do not currently know.
Let's not overuse it, but play. Sure.
But it's basically just... At this point, like, yeah, I mean, any event they could tie it to TGS if they wanted to, they could say before TGS. I mean, it doesn't.
I mean, I don't know whether it would really have any kind of genuine connectivity to TGS, but I agree with John. I think September feels like the right kind of time. It's far enough after E3 that we're not all thinking like, well, why didn't you just make it then?
Right.
But then it's far enough before. The build up to all the holiday shopping stuff and VR stuff hitting the market and all that, you know, it's not going to get totally drowned out, you know, or just see. I think September feels like the right kind of timing, but that's, you know, provided that they are going to kind of, we know, like, the earliest we could expect it is probably, you know, March next year. It's kind of provided that they are on course for that rather than it getting pushed for any further back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they would want to get ahead of the holiday shopping just because, you know, you might have people that otherwise would buy a PS4 or an Xbox One, and they're like, you know, since I just heard about the NX, I'll wait till the NX comes out. So,
especially based on whatever nonsense we're hearing out of Microsoft at this point. It's like, they're going to have 3 new models. It's like, what?
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's going to be...
Slow it down.
Absolutely.
What
there's
are you doing?
There's going to be people holding off just because of that, and, you know, it's... Behooves Nintendo to take advantage of that if they can, in any way possible.
Right, and if they can get, and if for whatever reason both of those platform holders talk about new hardware revisions right now, like, that's going to kind of suck if you already bought hardware. But, like, if they're both talking, it's just going to be kind of a wall of sound. Whereas if they tie it to September, whether or not TGS is related to that date, like, there's not going to be that noise around it. So they will get some of their own sort of spotlight moment. And yeah. Like I said, ultimately, they're showing off Zelda like any company would. Zelda's been in development for a long time and probably deserves the spotlight. Mm-hmm. So,
Also, I would say, compared to some Zelda situations, you know, I mean, they have shown so remarkably little of it to this point that this big reveal is kind of a lot more intriguing than just, you know, your average Zelda game at E3. I feel like, you know, like a lot of them tend to be at multiple E3s, and, you know, right. It's kind of some question about how long it's going to be before it actually comes out and all this kind of stuff. But now it kind of feels like, yeah, it's pretty much going to have to come out, you know, sometime, in the first half of next year, I would have thought.
This is a major event, just because.
So we have got pretty close to it. I know it still feels like a long way away for some people. Apparently, the delay of like up to 4 months was too long for them to take. I could do that standing on my head. I've been waiting 17 years for the Bills to get back in the playoffs.
Here we go.
You know, I mean, the fact is we've got this close. It is, you know, we're probably within about 9 months or so of it coming
out. We've known about this game for basically 2 years at this point.
We know sweet F.A. about it. I mean, generalities.
Do we need a Zelda Wii U siren?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you could extend it. But, you know, so the fact that now, you know, we are this, you know, it's a couple of weeks and the lid is going to get thoroughly blown off. I'm actually pretty excited about that.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, I think there's a kind of an undercurrent too of, you know, does Nintendo still have it? Can they still blow us away? You know, because they've had so many setbacks recently. You know, Zelda, it's an event game. Like, you know, everybody stops and looks to look at that game to see what Nintendo is doing with it.
Well, because console Zeldas are still pretty infrequent occurrences. For all the products that you get with Zelda on them, the remakes, the spin-offs, etc.
Right.
You know, this is still a kind of Smash Brothers style 5 or 6 years. You know, that's what we've been on with from Twilight Princess to Skyward Sword to now this.
Mm-hmm. And there is the prospect here of, because this game is such an unknown, and Nintendo is positioning it so squarely, like, I do wonder if that's a statement of supreme confidence. I don't, or just like, this is what we got.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is 3DS stuff they could be showing, so I don't know. But they are well positioned where if that thing comes out and kills, that like they walk away feeling pretty good from E3 despite having not been super committed. Like, if people come away from it, they're going, oh, shit. Like, that may be enough for them to do a victory lap, given that they didn't really commit a bunch of resources to this thing, relative to what they did, say, 5 years ago.
Well, and also relative to, you know, something like last year where, you know, you show a certain amount of stuff that people haven't, you know, that people don't know about already. And then, you know, obviously, such is the way of things on the internet and in life in general, to be honest, like, you know, the people focus on the negative, and there's a lot of attention paid to the reaction to Federation Force instead of some of the other things. You know, I mean, I get, that is the one thing I'll say about winnowing things down like this, is that, you know, if you are confident that Zelda's going to provoke positive reactions, that's all there's going to be, you know, I guess. You're not giving people something, sort of some salient point for other people, like, negativity to kind of rail on, you know, which will drown out some of the positive stuff.
Yeah. Well, John, I'm looking forward to our E3 coverage this year, so I'm glad you brought this up, because I think, unless they surprise us, our E3 coverage is going to be super easy, unlike last year where it was an unending nightmare.
Yeah, how many people are we going to have there, James?
How many people do we have there? I think five?
Five, yeah.
And I think they're all locals.
Yeah.
So it's not a big deal. But, you know, I mean, that's okay. Like, it's not the end of the world if we take it easy a year. Like, I suspect mm-hmm. that next year it will probably be a more involved event, or E3 will be dead. Like, that's really the,
yep.
It's really, like, that's the dichotomy, because Nintendo doesn't have more. Nintendo will have more to show next year. Invariably, they have to.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, at this point, Nintendo could just space world it up pretty much, and they could do their own thing.
I mean,
will it come back to that? That's what they need to do. They need to resurrect space world. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
But do it.
I mean, the developers have been making something for the last few years. So, like, presumably that's what they have to show us next year. But right now, they don't have that stuff. Mm-hmm. So next year, presumably, there is things to show. So which means they will either invariably have a larger show, or E3 will be dead and buried, and they'll be doing.
No, or of course they're going to take things from. Obviously, you'd think next year would be fundamentally different because you would have quite possibly NX already on the market. Early in its life, you're trying to push it. There was a lot more incentive to kind of do the traditional kind of show there, but. They are going to look at how well this sort of thing goes and how well it's been going for the past couple of years. And yeah, I mean, perhaps it might pick up a little bit from this, but yeah, there's a general direction of travel here that just kind of, it doesn't feel like E3's, if anything, that, like you said, the number of exhibitors and all that kind of stuff, it's just going to get smaller, surely. That's the way things are going.
I believe I have been informed there is a VR porn booth this year.
Mm-hmm. Well,
like that's the degree of exhibitors that are getting into main halls of E3.
For all the people that are going on about, I may have brought it up, like Nintendo floor space and all that. It's just really easy to get there.
It's super easy.
Just give it to us. We'll put a giant statue of Link in there if we have to fill it up.
Well, the thing is, you can get the word out about your products in much more cost effective ways now, just using like stuff like Nintendo Directs. I mean, these smaller companies that used to only have E3 as a venue to kind of hawk their wares to the a general audience, now they can just do that stuff online if they want to.
Yeah, they can. I mean, they can be active. So you have companies like Xseed who have a loyal fan base that they can market to directly because they interact with these people. They follow them on Twitter. They have their email addresses that they can super target market. Like if you're watching a bunch of certain videos on YouTube, they can identify you as a target demographic for their game and show just those people ads. Like that's what you can do now. So ultimately it becomes possible to really laser market your audience and not have to spend $1 million to get somebody from IGN to stop by and look at Akiba's beat.
Yep. You can say, hey, I have this game. That. I'm going to make the game website, sign up for this. And we know exactly who to market to because you just signed up for the game's website.
Right, or because you follow us on Twitter, you're already some kind of deviant. Here's more information about the game. Or you're watching a bunch of YouTube videos related to our products. Guess what ads you're going to see, because Google is smart like that.
Mm-hmm. Fucking Xseed. I had to unfollow their Twitter because the number of unsafe at work pictures was just getting...
It's not porn, but you're really selling this
Twitter thing to me.
Yeah. Well, just don't follow Xseed.
Just don't do it at work.
Yeah.
So follow Xseed.
No, I'm not saying I do that.
All right, and on that, you can follow us into Dracula's Castle when we come back from the break with our retroactive on Castlevania Rondo of Blood. Stay tuned.
Show you how to Twitter.
It's now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a preview, Mario and Sonic at the Rio 2016 Olympic Games on Wii U by Don. Mario and Sonic return, this time traveling to Brazil, where the government is incorruptible. The water is safe to swim in, and there is no risk of contracting the Zika virus whatsoever. I'm glad Mario and Sonic are cartoon characters, because it's probably the only thing that will ensure they survive in Rio. I don't write the script, people, I just read it. Mario and Sonic at the mosquito-borne illnesses clinic. That's the sequel. We have a review of Kirby Planet Robobot on 3DS by Neil Ronahan. If you like Kirby and giant mechs, this game's probably for you. If you like anything approaching manliness, this game is definitely not for you. Neil resides somewhere in the middle of both those extremes, so be sure to check out his review of the newest entry in the Kirby franchise. It's getting personal. It's getting personal in the Now Playing
segment. Has it
ever
not been personal in Now Playing, though?
That's true.
Yeah.
We need new targets. Hey, if you're an NWR staffer, write more non-news stuff so we can take shots at you.
Yeah. All right, and we have a preview of Seventh Dragon 3 Code VFD for 3DS by Neil Ronahan again. We've already discussed this title at length in New Business.
We did.
But get Neil's take on this dragon-chasing, time-traveling RPG. Read how he likes to combine his god hand with his pimp hand, which is already quite strong.
That's almost anti-taking shots at Neil. Like, we've really
gone
full circle on the Ronahan train.
Yeah, that's what I do in Now Playing. I give it and I take it away. So.
Okay.
All right, and we have a podcast, a new podcast, Cube Fight, with Neil Ronahan and Andy Gergen. In this new NWR podcast series, Neil and Andy take two first-party GameCube games and pit them against each other to come to an agreement on which is better, leading to a future ultimate showdown to figure out the best of the best. You can choose to listen or just save yourself some time and go play Metroid Prime.
Fuck you, John Lennon. Fuck you. You can go reach equally terrible conclusions right now at NintendoWorldReport.com. Back, it's time for our retroactive on Akumajo Dracula X no Chi no Rondo, or Castlevania Rondo of Blood. Where for the Turbo CD, also known as the what is it, the Turbo PC CD or Super CD or whatever.
I think on the boot up screen it's actually called the PC Engine CD Super System. I believe that's what Flash.
Yeah. It's like the Super CD-ROM squared or something. Like
their superscript is involved.
Yeah.
Yes. First off, before we get in there, NEC, fuck you. I just had to get that out because
so much hate on NEC, man. I don't understand. TurboGrafx-16. I love TurboGrafx-16.
Were you not satisfied with the 5 games for Super Graphics, James?
I need to know why the core graphics with the CD-ROM squared interface add-on has the big briefcase-looking thing to attach it all together.
Man, you just roll with it. TurboGrafx, it's a state of mind, man.
I need you to explain who cards to me, John.
Who cards? You know, Hudson, man. You just got to feel it in your heart. HU stands for heart. Your heart. Hue cards, man.
There were multiple CD-ROM formats for this stupid system, yes. But this is a regular Super CD game that came out for the TurboGrafx, the PC Engine, because Japan.
It didn't leave Japan, that's right.
Yeah, this came out after Super Castlevania 4, about 2 years after, and then the next one up was the Super Nintendo remake of this game.
Isn't it around about the same time as that weird sort of quasi remake of the original on the Sharp X68000 or whatever. For some reason, after having success with the Castlevania on NES, for 3 games, they decided to put it on everything, and have its own game on everything. Genesis, obviously, with Bloodlines.
Yeah, Bloodlines.
So PC Engine, X68000. I don't know why.
Castlevania Chronicles.
Yeah, that it was re-released on PS1 as Castlevania Chronicles, but I think it was just like...
It's just called Akumajo Dracula. Yeah.
Yeah, Demon Castle Dracula, because it was basically the first one, but with fancier graphics and, new design, but, it's so heavily patterned on the first one. But, I guess maybe Konami were already just getting really passive-aggressive with Nintendo at that point,
And to be fair, the Sharp X68000 wasn't exactly the most like blowing the doors off in sales either. Like, they were just putting this shit everywhere.
Yeah.
Let's put these out. But yeah, like, so this game is sort of a weird little, like, midpoint where you start to see the series kind of pivot, but it's still tied in pretty deep to where it is.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, Bloodlines is still very much a traditional action platforming game. It's also fucking weird. Bloodlines is really weird.
I would like to play that one day.
You should, because it's weird. But... You know, we've already had Super Castlevania IV come out, and that game is definitely more evolved than this one in some ways. But then you have, of course, you have this game's immediate sequel, which came out a few years later, which is, of course, Symphony.
Yes.
Which is way more evolved than this game.
Yeah,
and really,
I mean,
is when we start departing into... Is that, I guess that's the departure point for Egovania, isn't it?
Iga was listed on special thanks for this game, but wasn't particularly involved. Where that is the game that he, you know, Symphony of the Night is the first game that he really got deeply involved in Castlevania, and of course it's the first one that featured the Metroid inspired design.
Right.
Really, I mean, Simon's Quest you could talk about to some extent, the MSX Vampire Killer you could talk about to some extent. It weren't just, you know, linear action games, but in terms of, you know, that very heavily patterned on Metroid type of design, it starts there, and that's why that's where you get, you know, Metroidvania, Igavania, whatever you want to call it, from then on. And so this is a sort of weird little genesis for that, even though it is nothing like that in terms of its design. It is a you know, traditional linear action game for the most part, but it does have some interesting wrinkles that I'm sure we'll discuss.
Yeah, so I guess first let's start off. Who here had played this game prior to us doing this retroactive?
Oh yeah, I had the 100%ed the game, and I've got the save file to prove it. And in fact, I may not have finished the game this time around.
I was going to challenge you on it.
No, I mean, like, I really loved it back in the day. But...
We don't have to do it right here, but
right. Am I laggy, or what's going on?
No, you're not. You're not. Okay. I think we were all kind of like waiting for you to say like you were joking, and then like, no, you weren't joking, and then suddenly you got defensive, and we're like, wait,
if you do want to prove it, maybe someone can like knit you a patch to sew on your denim jacket or whatever.
That would be amazing. But yeah, like the. Yeah, but I don't recall the game. I remember playing the game in like two different. First, I finished the game with Maria because, you know, it's easy mode. And for a while, I was perfectly satisfied just leaving it at that, even though she's got her own ending. That's just really, really freaky and weird.
We'll talk about it.
Yeah, we will. But so, yeah, and I was content. Like, I was like, okay, so thank you, Konami, for giving me this easy mode, and maybe that's you know, I'll just stick with that. But then I'm not sure. I think maybe I finished the NES Castlevania for the first time on Wii Virtual Console, and then I picked up Rondo of Blood back up, and I was a little bit more at ease with the Belmont controls, and Richter controls better than most Belmonts.
Oh yeah.
So I think that, you know, that gave finishing the NES game gave me the confidence, the self-esteem I needed to to actually
make me more of a
try.
Man.
Yeah, to actually give it a shot, you know.
My history is very similar to Gilb's in one sense and completely different in another, because I played through this on Virtual Console too, you know, although I had it a little early because I had the Japanese Wii. I did speak about it on a very old episode of RFN. It's at the back end of 2008. So you find an episode that's somewhere around there. I talk about this, play this for the first time. All those years ago, but I got 100%, enjoyed the game a lot back then. But the difference is, Castlevania, the NES, was one of the first games I ever played, and I absolutely adored it. So I was already very at home with all the, you know, the conventions of the series and all that kind of stuff. And it was a super exciting thing for me because this, you know, I'd long been touted, you know, on the internet, especially as, you know, one of the great Castlevania games in the classic mold.
you know, that I really loved, but, you know, I hadn't had the chance to play it, you know, and so it was a huge deal when I had the chance to do it. And even with all those years of sort of hype, I guess you could say, expectation, whatever, it still delivered, which is, that's tough, you know, when normally if you're building something up in your head for a long time, you know, it's almost inevitable it's going to disappoint you to some degree, but I wouldn't say that. I really loved it, and I enjoyed playing through it again just now.
So I had, so my Castlevania experience, I'd played some of the NES games as rentals, because as we've discussed in the past, my parents only bought me bad NES games.
You're that kid.
So they could have actually bought me Simon's Quest, but they didn't. So yay for that. I will stand by that statement. The English version of that game is borderline unplayable without a guide, which, like,
it's, well,
it has issues and design wise, it's got some
squat on this point for exactly 12 seconds, so the boat shows up.
Yeah, like, but exactly. literally every neighborhood had at least one kid subscribing to Nintendo Power.
Oh,
so
I know,
it wasn't really that much of a problem.
Yeah, the game also has a color palette like Super Mario 3,
if,
by the way.
If you didn't have that...
The helpful thing is you could tell that kid apart because he'd been traumatized by the Nintendo Power cover with the decapitated Dracula head. So you knew who to ask about all the various arcana of Simon's
Quest. My experience with it was really playing Super Castlevania 4 at my cousin's house and beating it in a day. Like, just... locking down and just going on that game hard and finally just getting through it. And, like, that became sort of defining Castlevania for me. And my Metroidvania sort of proclivities being known as what they are, I never really got in on the GBA game. So I sort of missed that whole era of Castlevania, that sort of late era Castlevania. So for me, the series has always been defined by 4. And not by my little dalliances with the first, with Castlevania 1 and 3 that I had when I rented it as a very small child. So all I knew about this game was that it is closer to 4 than it is to the newer stuff in a lot of ways. And that, seriously, no, like, this game's really Japanese. Like,
yeah.
be on guard.
It's kind of strange, isn't it? Because the about Castlevania, obviously, you know, when the Famicom NES era, you know, the original Castlevania came out for the Famicom Disk System in 86, you know, so it was a little while into the NES and into the Famicom and the FDS sort of life, so that, yeah, the boom had started. Like, I guess everything sold pretty well, you know, that had a certain amount behind it on that. But in relative terms, it probably was more successful in the West. You know, it was patterned on, you know, Western horror movies to some extent, you know, the Universal, and I guess to some extent the Hammer movies from Britain in the 60s as well, you know, so, like, I guess it was always felt like it was more aimed at kind of those kinds of people. But then in this case, you've got a game that, you know, is for a format that was only ever, you know, somewhat popular in Japan. It never left Japan, so it's this really weird sort of thing, and accordingly it has quite a different sort of style in certain regards. You know, it is
to reuse the phrase "anime is happening."
Yeah, you've got these anime scenes which aren't really very animated. You know? Like, I mean,
they are exactly what you expect from that era, because the stylistically and so I streamed this a bunch the other night, and stylistically, it looks like an early 90s anime, but there's a bunch of, like, games that came out, like, semi-visual novel adventure games that came out in Japan that time period. Stuff on the Playdia looked like that.
You had a lot of, like, shooters as well that had kind of cutscenes like this.
Police Knots looks like that a lot. Very similar to this. Like, this was a way of doing, as opposed to when the West was trying to do FMV and just making us all vomit with this horrible compression, they were doing these stills where they animated very specific parts of the body to sort of get you there. Mm-hmm. And the way they sort of tried to tie it back together was putting in really overproduced audio.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of caught me off guard because, like, I had never played this, and I actually, I'm surprised that I hadn't played it because when I bought my NES, I think back in 87... was when I bought it. this was the game that I bought with it. I mean, I bought not this game, but I bought Castlevania, the original. I bought it
right
with my NES. So I've literally been playing it since the first game. And I've played almost all of them, but this is one of the ones I'd never played. And it was interesting how much anime was happening in this.
Oh, anime is happening all over the place here.
Yeah, and it was just, it was weird because...
But in the best way. In the most beautiful, like, FM Towns Marty kind of way.
Yeah.
I guess it's appropriate that the systems that I keep thinking of when I look at this game are also Japan-only systems, because ultimately, or predominantly Japanese systems, because they're like, there's this weird culture of games that we just didn't see.
Mm-hmm.
And, like... This is kind of an interesting thing to see it because there's not a bunch of TG16 games that fall into this. I mean, I guess our Lords of Thunder do sort of have this kind of stuff in there, but not the same way.
Yeah,
it's not,
I mean,
cartoony.
They were big on this for the CD stuff. But yeah, I mean, I was just surprised that there was anime to this extent in it.
Yeah,
like they're actually. It was weird, especially at this time period, seeing like the character of Richter being anime-tized.
Because the other Belmonts are very like Arnie and Conan.
Ryu's a Shoto character. Excuse me. Richter is a Shoto character in that he looks like Ryu.
Yeah, absolutely.
He is straight up a Shoto clone, which is amazing to think about. You think about Japan made their hero for themselves, and they said, you know who that is really cool? Ryu. Ryu's really cool. let's make him look like SNK made Ryu 3 years earlier than they made some King of Fighters character that looks like Ryu. Here he is. And it's really freaking crazy to look at him, because the first time you see him, you're like, he's a Belmont? What part of the Belmont family is he from?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
The one that rips their sleeves and turns into a headband?
Hundreds of years later. I mean, it was still like the 18th century, but, you know, time had moved on.
That's right. It's a different game for a different era, I think is the best way to describe this game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I loved it more for it. Like, I love all the silliness in place. I like that when Maria is this 12-year-old blonde girl in a frilly dress who summons, so what she's summoning is she's summoning essentially animal spirits to assist her, including like the Chinese dragon spirits, Chinese zodiacs, like the turtle, the
cat.
Dragon, the cat, aka the tiger.
That's supposed to be a tiger?
Yeah.
A baby the white tiger, yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah, the phoenix.
it's a tiger because when you use the item crash, the giant version of the tiger just zooms across the screen at the bottom and then at the top, and Maria is riding it.
Yes.
It is glorious.
I don't think I ever felt the need to use item crash in Maria.
Yeah, I was just looking them up yesterday. I should try this at least, and it's amazing.
Yeah. my favorite part of Maria is whenever she's on the scene, she's yelling like a 12-year-old girl in an early 90s anime. So when she beats Dracula, what does she do? She scolds him and calls him a bad man. And like, he basically is just like, whatever, I'm peacing out, see you later. And then he goes, because he knows he's coming back. And the castle collapses, and then she runs with her animal friends in a field. It's like, yeah, this game is so gleefully Japanese.
It's very kind of, I mean, I guess some of it might be a function of, you know, the limitations of the PC engine and the CD. So in terms of, you know, like, so even though you've got the CD here, so you've got more memory, they use that for music, presumably it freed them up in terms of assets and stuff. So you wouldn't be worried about running out. And of course they use it for those anime sequences, but in terms of like the color palette and stuff, I guess it maybe led them to try and use like quite bright colors rather than sort of trying to have Castlevania 4 is quite muted, but because Super Nintendo had a really sort of good for the time color palette, it could do it without just looking like brown, you know, like
washed out.
It had, It was sort of muted, but it had, you know, certain amount of richness to it. It wasn't too kind of drab looking. But, you know, if you tried to go for the same look on PC Engine, presumably, it just wouldn't have looked that nice at all. So they just, I think that might have played into the idea. Yeah, let's go bright and colourful with it. And, you know, they kind of went from there. It's got, I mean, mood-wise, it is pretty much the polar opposite from Castlevania IV. I mean, the first three on NES, they have kind of a little bit of a goofy kind of bent to them, like with the credits, you know, like Christopher yep. B and Fred Astaire and all that stupid stuff. But it yeah. wasn't as brazenly silly as something like Ghosts and Goblins. Mm-hmm. And then you right. get to four on Super Nintendo, and that's very moody. The soundtrack, which is, I believe, absolutely fantastic, is quite downbeat, quite melancholy at times. It's very rich, you know.
It's spooky.
Spooky, yeah, it tries to go for like a horror film type of thing at times. Sometimes it goes like very classical and stuff. You know, then there's this, which sounds very arcadey, very upbeat. You know, get the guitar going, you know, it tends to, at least for one path through the game, reprise like the most anthemic songs from the NES Castlevania games. So yep. it's right. just it, like the complete other way of sort of, whereas, you know, the Super Nintendo game took the well, you know, the Castlevania 4 took the, you know, the sort of serious kind of part of the NES games. This took the goofy part and ran with it a long way.
So we have a comment about that from the talkback, and this was from P. Patco, and basically he talks about how the music is such a departure from other games in the series before and after. He was not a fan. Even the classic games in the early 80s, excuse me, even the classic tunes from this game, so he's referring to like your Vampire Killers and your Bloody Tears, have an early 80s/90s pop vibe. And quote, I almost expect Paula Abdul to start belting out at any moment. He's looking at stage 5 specifically. And then thankfully the series returned to the gothic orchestral hard rock style in the games following. But you know, I really just dig that music as part of what this game is. Mm-hmm. I mean, well,
it fits it. It fits the bright colors and the kind of mood to it. It is a good fit. And some of those arrangements of the classic Castlevania tunes I quite like. You know, as a whole, I get probably just like reflecting my personality or whatever. I kind of like the melancholy vibe a little more. But, you know, I think this is good. This is good for what it wants to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it kind of helped. And I think, you know, there was kind of a bit of a rock sensibility that went into
totally.
The NES soundtracks, and then this kind of took that a bit further, and even sort of like Symphony of the Night that went heavier on, you know, kind of, I think Symphony of the Night did a really good job of kind of synthesizing, you know, the Castlevania 4 outlook and the Rondo of Blood outlook, because, you know, it's got the hard rock kind of stuff in there, you know, it's got the guitar driven stuff, but then it's got the harpsichord driven stuff, you know, that kind of, it really does sort of marry them together, and that kind of became the Castlevania vibe from then on.
I mean, bear in mind too that the synthesis was on CD at the time. CDs were very new. So
this is Redbook Audio, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
So you
I
could
mean,
put
so,
that in your car CD player and just listen to some tunes.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's why all these games have these kind of butt rock soundtracks, is because they were just trying to go all out with
they
CD
could.
Audio.
I mean, this goes back to our Lords of Thunder conversations.
Yep.
Like here, we have CD audio on the system, and this was a very early system to get it.
Yes.
Let's use it. And because it got it so early in part because of, we talked about the limitations of the hardware of this system. It really wasn't a 16-bit system in the era of 16-bit systems. So it was like, well, what can we do? We'll throw CD on there. We can put more stuff on it. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about it is because using like actual music was so new, a lot of the tracks loop really badly. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
they'll just fade out
and then just start back up again. Yeah, it's,
and there'll be like a beat there, like of just nothing.
And yet, you know, like might be old, but it's still, they did it better than the Mega Man classic collection on the GameCube.
Yeah. That, there's a lot wrong with that game. So I will say that we spent a lot of time on the music, but I want to say that I actually like this music more than Super Castlevania 4. And I think it's because I'm so into this early, dumb, stupid anime of my childhood, like stuff that I would see on local channels, where they've just dubbed it really terrible. And like, there's just something about the music, and This is my favorite Bloody Tears ever. This might be my favorite vampire killer ever, door sound effects and all.
Yeah.
But there's like this hard drive, and he's right, it is kind of like 90s synthesizer use. Like it's
mostly. It I mean, starts like, Bloody Tears got the organ going, which is sort of more,
and then it flips into electronic organ at some point. Like it's weird sounding, but it drives so hard.
And to be fair, also, it does contribute some themes that would go on to be really big in the series through Symphony of the Night. And even Castlevania 64 actually uses a few of these. But, you know, like the first level with the burning town, that Bloodlines theme has been used loads of times. If you remember the Castlevania 64 title screen, it's the child Malice playing that on the violin. Very different version, you know, not upbeat and, you know, it's quite moody and quite pretty. But that's been remixed 100 different times. And also the battle with Dracula music, Dance of Illusions, is in Castlevania 64 and in a hall book together. That kind of became the go-to Dracula battle theme.
I didn't realize that was the origin of that song.
Yeah, no, it debuted here. So it did make some really important contributions to sort of Castlevania musical history.
It's a cool game, like and just presentationally. Like there's a lot going on here that makes it. Well, I say it makes it stand out, but really it sort of sets a goal for where we're gonna go, because with Symphony, you know, I referred to this game as anime is happening, but Symphony sort of reflects where anime had gone at that point too, because it's gotten to this weird like late 90s kind of edgy, big hair, big you know, ornate clothing of Dracula. Like Dracula is what is effectively a Bishonen character at this point. And you have Alucard. Like, this is where these things are going. So it does actually kind of reflect the sensibilities of the era in which it existed. And you see that continue right up until you start seeing the stuff on the GBA and DS. Where they like characters. Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, they look like characters from a bad TV show from that era is what I was going to say.
Hmm. You're making me want to see like a 19... I don't know, like 60s version of Castlevania with like the Astro Boy kind of look.
That would be super cool.
It would be
super
cool.
I would be super on board with that. I would be super excited.
Yeah.
But like, it's
what could have been.
It is showing, I think ultimately it speaks more to that, freed from the constraints of trying to make a game that appeals outside of their market, although that doesn't explain why the second Castlevania, the one that only came out on, what was it? The MG, not the MG, the MX, mm-hmm. Doesn't have this in there. Like it feels like they're willing to let themselves be more exposed to sort of their local culture. And then if you go look at Bloodlines, a game that almost explicitly exists for the benefit of Western markets,
yeah,
and is a middle finger to Nintendo, that game looks like butt. I mean, that game looks awful.
Yeah, that was like trying to tie into the Dracula novel and all this. I mean, that was just, again, kind of the as far away to a different approach as you could possibly get, really.
Yeah.
You know, like it was totally, because the Mega Drive in Japan was not very relevant. So that was none of their games for that system were really geared for Japan.
And they just tried to make all the enemies look gory and gross. And so, in the end, you've got enemies that look like, to quote Vinnie Caravella of Giant Bomb, a giant trash bag with legs. And, like, that's a boss. And it's one of the worst bosses I've ever seen in a game, ever. It just looks like garbage. That game has so much bad design, it's kind of amazing. And that game came out a year after this one, from the same company.
Well, of course, you could say that... The sprites in the Rondo really did stand the test of time.
They sure
at least according to the people within Konami, because boy, did they get some mileage out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thought when they were making this that one day there'll be this weird like multiplayer game on Xbox 360? You don't know what that is yet, but you know, Microsoft
on a Microsoft built console. Yeah. That's not
and, the same.
That's not the X68000.
The same sprites are still going to be getting used on it all those years later.
Yeah, and because it's an HD game, like the graphics are super small, right? Like I've never played.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
That game is hilarious because everything is so small. It's such a crazy. And they basically said, "Well, we should make it a big multiplayer arena game. That's how we'll deal with it. Let's not remake the assets. That would be work."
No, are these sprites also used in the puzzle game that was released on what mobile platforms?
Oh, Puzzle of the
Probably.
Night or whatever this. I assume so,
Puzzle of
it's
the
Night based on Symphony, isn't it? Yes, and Symphony obviously reused it. That was an actual thing to do because Symphony was a sequel. It carried,
but
on
it
the
wasn't
story.
Like that. The PlayStation's two console generations above the Turbo Duo.
It's like one and a half, but yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I think it's just that as you've been noted, you know, Symphony was kind of a weird side project. It was, it wasn't like the didn't have a huge budget. It wasn't meant to necessarily like carry the torch for Castlevania, you know, and it was the sequel to a game that, you know, was not a huge installment in the series, being isolated on that platform and in Japan only. So, you know, it was just this project they had for Castlevania, for the PlayStation. They probably didn't even know whether it would get out of Japan because Sony had such a hostile attitude towards sprite art games back then.
They did.
Outside of Japan. So, you know, they weren't looking at that as anything big. They probably had bigger hopes for Castlevania 64. But, you know, because then Symphony came to define Castlevania and for such a long time, to a large degree, then, you know, those sprites became immortalized to a great degree.
So let's get on to gameplay. We could talk about the anime sequences all day, and they're amazing. And Maria's win animation is the best. But let's actually talk about what makes this game, how this game plays. Who wants to take the lead on this particular topic?
The first thing that struck players, I'm sure, is that after the Super Nintendo version just gave us like eight. Or was it eight? Or is it six? Anyway, like whip directions. You can't whip below you, but yeah, like you could whip all around you, and you had these kind of hooks.
Wave your whip
you
around limp-wristedly.
Yeah, that was really weird. So a lot of people, I think, going from the Super Nintendo game to Rondo of Blood kind of missed that. But Rondo of Blood is not designed so that you miss it. You know, it's kind of like a Mega Man game. Like,
right.
you're meant to hit forward. You know, you're meant to attack what's in front
of you. Oh, absolutely. I think mm-hmm. that's a crucial point. I mean, Castlevania IV, it's not like you could take the whip use out of it, because this place is, you know, where you're like, you're whipping onto those sort of hooks that you swing from, kind of Indiana yep. Jones style, all that. I mean, you know, obviously it's designed around it to some extent, but there's elements of enemy placement and all that that just don't seem like they really were well thought out for that kind of flexibility. You know, you'll be on the stairs and there's an enemy on the stairs above you and you can just whip straight up and kill it. Mm-hmm. What is it there for? Like it's defenseless against eight directional whipping. It's not really an impediment. So it's you know, normally that would be the kind of thing like, oh well, if I've got the axe, I can kill it really easily. But if I haven't, you know, I'm gonna have to be really careful. Well, Castlevania IV, you still had enemies that were placed that way for some reason that just were just sort of fodder ultimately. Rondo mm-hmm. feels a bit more kind of deliberate, a bit more considered for the, you know, the restrictions of the character, which harken yeah. back more to the NES Castlevanias. You know, so, you know,
yeah,
although
but still
I
with some welcome
of...
improvements to the way that you jump, because for the yeah. first time you can actually, well, yeah, for unlike the NES games, you can actually kind of slow down. You can't change direction midair like you can with Mario. But you can basically, like, if you're going to overshoot your target, you can press back and not fall as far, or you can,
yeah,
you know, like, you can feather it a little bit.
Yeah, it's a really interesting reading the comments about this, that, you know, it seems like not everyone quite appreciates exactly what's going on with the jumping mechanics in this game, because it's Castlevania 1 through 3... it's basically kind of Ghosts and Goblins-ish. You know, you could jump on the spot, or you can jump a fixed distance left or right. That's, you know, that's it, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Castlevania 4, you've got a pretty good range of control over your movement in the air. But with this one, it's a little more complicated than that, because what happens is that there's a few different kinds of, again, you could jump on the spot or you could do a sort of full jump left or right, but there's what I call the timid jump. Now, this is for where you're worried about overshooting something, for it, or like jumping into an enemy. So you jump on the spot, so you're not pressing a direction, and then once in the air, press yep. left or right, and it will start moving a little bit. So it's like a little half a jump, third a jump, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty useful. But then the other aspect of it is you can affect him in the air if you yeah. hold down the jump button. That's unlike Castlevania 4, where you can just move the directions in the air. In this case, if you don't hold down the jump button, you won't affect the arc of his jump. You will just face the other way, potentially
right.
to like whip something that was trailing you or something.
But yeah, I had trouble figuring this out.
Yeah,
especially
if you
on
hold
bridge
the
sequence.
Jump button. Yeah, and it is kind of important for that
yeah.
sequence.
I was surprised that I could move in midair. I was like, wait a minute, whoa. This doesn't feel like Castlevania at all.
Yeah, like I said, but I mean, even this was also true because I played Castlevania Chronicles for the PS1 and played the original version. Let's say we did that. They made the same change there that they did for Castlevania 4, where you could just control it by wiggling the D-pad left and right. This was a weird kind of not quite that. You have to hold the jump button to do that, or otherwise you'll face the other way and whip in that, attack in that direction. So I guess it was to preserve those two things. Like, do you want to attack behind you or do you want to affect the arc of your jump? But it seems like from reading some of the comments and stuff that the result of that design choice was that some people just assumed it was like the NES games and you couldn't affect him in the air and right. therefore made them a hell of a lot more reticent to actually use Richter and probably made Maria seem even more sort of overpowered.
Because of her double jump, yes.
Yeah, the double jump's very useful.
We have comments from the NeoGAF thread where there was actually a debate between two posters there about the jumping in the game, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit. So Vicious Killer Squirrels, whose post read something along the lines of, overall, I can't help but feel the move away from the slow-moving juggernauts to the over to the agile magic users was the right choice to make, referencing the later games in the franchise. It feels as though 2D platforming had moved on from the early Castlevania style of committed jumping that you see in this game with Super Mario Brothers. When Castlevania came out, I could see it having been acceptable because it was still early days, but by Rondo, it had become a quaint throwback to an earlier time. Even as the prologue symphony shed the stiff jumping and gave Richter better movement options, perhaps sensitive to the fact the controls were barely acceptable in 1993, let alone in 1997. In the end, the iconic whip. I'll leave that part out. So you can see there that like. Actually, some of the stuff isn't there, but he's got a point where you did need to get away from having these binary jumps. And the game does do that, but yeah, not in a way that's immediately apparent that it's doing it.
Yeah, I guess
and,
so.
And because I'm so used to playing Mario games, I guess, I was always holding down the jump button, even though you don't need to. And so I never even knew that you had this weird kind of flipping, changing, whipping direction in midair thing. So that's good to know.
Well, it's also weird. I think it's primarily because the NES games were one where it didn't matter that you were holding the jump button down, and then also with the Super NES game, you could control it just by wiggling the D-pad. So if you just kind of put those two together and think, is it one or the other? You're just going to think it's the NES game, but actually it's this weird little extra bit of nuance. And I could confirm that is the same in the Super Nintendo Dracula X as well. Because obviously it carries over many things from Rondo, but those mechanics are the same there too.
I was playing it for a while, and I could tell there was something going on, but it wasn't until, looking at the chat as I was streaming this last night, that, people were telling me, no, try things, and I wasn't piecing together what they were saying because it doesn't make sense when you think about it. Like you think, if you hold the button and press the button, a different thing happens. But like once you do it enough, this is actually important. Like this is how you actually control Richter, because in fact, there's other stuff like Richter's backflip.
I think is a really crucial addition, and one I think is a lot of fun. Actually, I'd love the backflip in this game.
But like, there's all kinds of weird nuance in the jumping that the game makes. I mean, granted, it's in Japanese.
Yeah.
But the game is not making an effort to explain that, or in fact, to make sure you know how to do it. You can very easily get to the bridge, which is in level 7. It's basically the last real level. Yeah. And the bridge is unbeatable unless you understand how to turn midair and attack.
I probably wouldn't have any idea. I didn't even know you could backflip. No idea.
Yeah, that's a little
tricky.
It's a double tap. You double tap the jump button, and then you can. And really, I think yes, it has certain platforming applications. There's certain candles you can get up to whip if you didn't have an axe to take them out by doing that and whip it at the top of the arc and all that, and at some platforms you can get to using it. But for me, it's the combat part of it that really makes it, because a number of the enemies feel very specifically designed around it. Because say for instance you engage in an axe armor type of thing, now normally he just throws his axes much as they did in the NES Castlevania and all that, but then he'll sort of tip you off that he's going to charge, and you've got a while to react, and then he starts running towards you very fast. And if you were just going to, turn and walk away, very slowly, it's with Richter's stiff movement, as people have said, there's more flexibility than there was in the NES games, but fundamentally it's not that different. He still is kind of stiff and stuff. But, once you see them start to charge, you just do that backflip, bail out. And then, you will avoid that attack, and then you can get back to it. So it's just that, you can get in there, sort of really go after these people aggressively, then bail out, come back for more. It's got this really nice rhythm to it that I feel like, you know, I always like the rhythm to attacking enemies in the original Castlevania, but this I just feel kind of adds that bit of extra something to it. You know, a lot when paired with the more complex attack patterns that the enemies have now, that's really cool. I think that's the part that for me really takes, when you played as Richter, kind of takes it to another level.
Yeah, and the bosses, when you face them, when you don't take any damage against them, you gain a 1-up. And there's a particular boss, the Minotaur, where when you kill the bosses, like, they do one final attack.
They're in their death throes.
Yeah, they're in their death throes, and it can't kill you, but it can damage you, so you're not going to get that extra 1-up. And I thought, like, wow, with Richter, like, it's impossible to jump over that final attack. I don't know what to do. And I was just digging up, like, when I played this, I was playing in a game club on negativeworld.org. So I dug up the thread, and I just love this quote from Matthew Taranto, who's the Brawl in the Family comic strip. He says, by the way, you can dodge the stage 3 boss's final attack with a well-timed backflip. I did it earlier today, and it was super manly.
That's the thing. I mean, it does. It just adds this element of dodging to the game. That's a lot more. You know, before, the only kind of twitch dodging you'd really do would be ducking. You know, that's so. You know, maybe if you've got those sort of bone dragon heads and you're ducking to avoid something, or otherwise, if it was like, okay, let me get off the spot, walk back. It just, you know, you would have to do it, but it just it didn't feel that great.
But it's my first reflex all the time, though. That's always what I do. Like, whenever there's a freaking skeleton throwing bones at me or whatever it is, I just, like, okay, turn away, jump away, and come back when it's safe. I haven't really mastered the backflip, so I guess I'm not manly enough.
And you don't really need it to beat the game either.
It feels a hell of a lot better as an experience. Yeah. And certainly some of the bosses would be a lot easier if you really use it.
Oh, totally.
I'm thinking of Shaft's Ghost, you know, the last boss before you get to the Castle Keep, where it summons the sort of behemoth bald thing zombie form. They, like, backflipping away from that is pretty important to avoid damage.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the bosses in this game, because they're kind of crazy. Like, so this is the departure from, as you said, from, like, the Universal Studios Pictures monsters. I mean, you do get your Frankenstein and your mummy, but they're all jammed together in this one boss rush.
In the Shaft level, where he summons all the first four bosses from Castlevania, and you get the boss music from the original Castlevania Poison Mind to accompany, which is, that's the thing. I mean, you know, for a game that, on the one that we talked about, it striking such a tone of its own, you know, that was Japanese and all this. There's plenty of Castlevania fan service in this game. The Burning Town from the second one, you know, like the Castle Keep being so similar to the original, and then, yeah, you know, all the bosses from Castlevania 1. There's lots of nice references there for people who did love the series.
But, like, the bosses in this game are pretty different. So, I mean, Death showed up in 3, but Death in this game is an anime character. I mean, he literally throws off a cowl and is wearing, like his gi, and then summons a blood-red laser axe, and then shows up and, like, starts taunting you. Like, Death's a really cool dude in this game.
And he summons, like, those giant green flaming, like, skulls. Oh, yes. Which in Castlevania 64 became giant fish for some reason.
Death is a well-known fish expert.
I guess the one he summons at the start, when in the prologue, when you're on the carriage, that kind of looks like a fish. I guess that's how they got there, but I don't know what it was meant to be.
Does that entire intro remind anybody else of, like, a 90s rock album cover? Like, standing on a carriage, riding with a whip against Death and a scythe? It's like, there's something really crazy about that intro. That game starts going 100 miles an hour, literally, and you know, metaphorically, and doesn't let up. But, like, a lot of the enemies are different. Like, the Wolfman in this one is he's a Mega Man boss. Like, he fights like a Mega Man X boss.
That's true, yeah.
He clings to walls. He, just rushes at you. And, I don't know, like, he's very fast.
Target. Yeah, like, he fights... I mean, granted, this is pre-Mega Man. Is it pre-Mega Man X? Yeah,
right,
I guess it's... No, it's not.
It's not.
No, so he feels like a boss from one of those games. Like, not even classic Mega Man. He's bouncing off walls and going into balls and spinning at you. Like, he's a legitimately crazy boss fight.
Mm-hmm.
The Shaft boss fights, all of them are nuts in different ways. And to some extent, like, that makes the Dracula fight feel kind of...
Yeah, I've said this plenty of times, I think when I've discussed this game, the Dracula fight is pretty weak in this one. It's, again, I guess it is a reference to the original. This is one case where it's really strongly referenced in the first game. You know, the whole, you know, coming up the stairs and everything. But then even the second form, there's just not a lot going on. It's big. It's a big sprite, but beyond that,
if you're Maria, you can take away half his health before his health bar even shows up.
Maria, that encounter is totally broken for Maria because she could do the slide under him as well. I mean, that's the only thing that makes it kind of tricky. He's so big, it's kind of tricky with the Richter's somewhat plodding pace to get in under his feet when he jumps. But she can do it really easily.
Slides under him.
Dracula is toast when you've got Maria. So yeah, it's you know, like that, he's an anticlimax. But I would say, in general, the bosses, you know, they're kind of weird and wonderful, but just mechanically, they're a pretty big improvement over most classic Castlevania bosses.
I would say,
because, you know, Castlevania 4 has some visually cool bosses and the odd encounter, which I think works well. But very often, especially if you've got there with a decent amount of health, you can brute force it. You could just kind of devolve into let me just keep whipping this guy, and he can't hurt me enough to make it a problem. These guys, maybe there's some of that going on if you've got there with a lot of hearts and you abuse the item crash, maybe. Other than that, I think, you know, they've got certain attacks which could do a lot of damage, which would get you in real trouble. So I certainly found it easier rather than just get in there with some, you know, ridiculous arsenal that they couldn't stand against. Just learning the patterns, you're using the backflip, all that kind of stuff, dodging their attacks and dealing the damage and getting it done. I think it's one of the, apart from Dracula, maybe one or two others, it's probably the strongest field of bosses that they assembled in a classic Castlevania game.
Yeah, I was surprised at how hard it was to cheese bosses.
Oh, yeah. Like, you have to get good at what they want you to be good at.
Yep.
Yeah, and they so want you to get good at beating the bosses that you can unlock these videos that you can watch where you see like an expert player just trounce them without really getting hit and stuff like that. It's pretty impressive. Although, like, I'm watching these videos and the guy is just like weirdly trying to show off or something, because the video shows you the room before the boss, and like it shows you where to find like the hidden, you know, wall chicken or whatever it is. And then it shows you the boss fight. But when they're collecting these items at the beginning, like, he's not just straight whipping at the candles and getting the items. He's going to be like backflipping and whipping and then grabbing item and just like dancing around.
He's hot dogging it. That's my
The Dracula one amuses me because he is murdering Dracula. He's getting off two whip hits per fireball set, which is crazy when you think about it. And as opposed to just ending Dracula with the whip, he makes very sure to give Dracula space so he can hit him with the boomerang on both cases. Yeah. It's like, are you just showing off? Just stop it.
The only kind of hot dogging I ever did in Castlevania was catching the boomerang when there was no point. It's not like you get the heart back. I caught it, you know. So
it's the same thing as when there's the orb that appears when you beat a boss. Like, I always jump to catch it. It's like in Super Mario 3.
At its highest point. That's what, you know.
Yeah.
I
backflip and I try to have the screen stop at a very specific frame, you know, so that Maria is upside down or whatever. It's pretty cool.
Trying to get a pantsu shot. I see. I was doing it with her turtle, so I would like try to hit the button so it would just be covering her head, because as it spawns in.
I think one thing that we should say about the changes that it made from previous Castlevania games that kind of play into this as well is, like, you know, I mean, the sub-weapons are still there. You know, they added the item crash, which can use, like, a bunch of hearts for, like, a screen-filling attack, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they got rid of doubles and triples, which, you know, were a thing
right.
which could make you extremely powerful in the NES trilogy of games and Castlevania 4. But then also, if you died, it was a long way down. It kind of had that. You know, Castlevania was not like Gradius in that, you know, it was a home game. You know, there was Haunted Castle in the arcade, which sucks, but that's by the by. It was just a game conceived for the home market. Mm-hmm. And it was also conceived to have a save system on the FDS, which they didn't bring over to the NES. But the point is, it had that arcade sensibility of, like, oh yeah, you can get on a roll, but if you make one mistake, then, you know, it's a long way down to having just, you know, no sub weapon. Even your mm-hmm. whip needs to be powered back up.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. Like, yeah, I'm really thankful. Like, it really brings back what you were saying about Star Fox Zero. You know, the fact that you always know what you start with in terms of lasers.
Exactly.
It's the same thing here. You don't have to upgrade the whip. So when you die just before the boss and then the checkpoint, you know, like, you're not struggling and just dealing half damage with a short whip, you know?
Yeah, they're going to have to go in with a crappy leather whip, you know, like that. Yeah. That was always kind of the indignity of dying in the old Castlevania game. So mm-hmm. I really like that, actually. I really like that it feels like everything is a bit more meticulously designed. His whip's got a pretty nice range on it, you know. So, I mean, that's the thing. There's a little bit of Zelda 2 to the combat in this, in terms of the ducking and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, luckily Richter's whip is not really tiny. Like, that's the problem with Zelda. He's stabbing you with a pocket knife, you've got a really juicy kind of rage on his combat. So for, yes, he has limitations, but, you know, he's once you really get your head around it, he's really quite capable, and the bosses play into that nicely.
Going back to the comments, and this was part of that debate, Sir Il Palzo, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, commented on how in the classic Castlevanias, you felt very, you know, very constrained and had to carefully measure when you jump and attack. And he sort of viewed that as part and parcel of what that game was going for and being kind of spooky, scary. You're this weak human trying to kill Dracula, the king of the vampires. But in 4, especially, you start having all these, you know, you have, like, the highly controllable whip that's much longer. You start having these things that let you kind of break the game, like these power-ups. And it's a very different kind of conceit, whereas this game is super meticulously sculpted to, we know what you have. We're going to try to force-feed you the power-up we think you should have.
Yeah, the power-up thing is a very good point. Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, that is a very good point, because the thing is, again, with the whole triples thing, you didn't want to switch power-ups, ever.
Right,
you know, like,
yeah.
Once you got, you know, like, once you had something up to a triple, you know, you didn't want to then say, well, triple boomerangs is good, but I'd like triple holy water, because, you know, you would just go down to single holy water. So,
right.
you know, in this case, getting rid of the triples and all that just takes that out of it. And they add the thing wherein, if you collect a sub-weapon sort of by accident, the old one doesn't just disappear straight away.
Oh, that's
so good.
It goes
to the side of you, and you can say, well, no, actually, I didn't want the dagger. I'd like to keep the axe, thanks, you know, because it's going to be really helpful in a minute. You know, so, you know, and very often, like you said, I mean, it will drop one specifically because, like, there's going to be, I mean, for instance, the bridge sequence you spoke about at the beginning of the final level, essentially, those bats that are chasing you go down in one hit from the axe. And
they're holding,
you know,
a sword, by the way.
Yeah, sword wielding bats.
A claymore.
Why not?
Freaking claymore.
But, you know, so, yeah, very often it will give you, you know, a weapon that feels like that bit of the level was designed around its use as well. But, you know, I guess you could attack it a different way if you wanted to, but, you know, just those, the greater options and the greater sort of considered nature of the design, I think, is another thing that makes this a step above the other classic Castlevania games.
It means they can make sure that you're playing, and this was the point that he was trying to get at. It means they can design the game around making sure you know how to play the game. like, you know, using the phrase he uses, using the tools correctly. And that there's a lot of that. So when I finally beat Dracula as Richter yesterday, like, it was really about understanding those jumps that you have to do to get over Dracula's fireballs in his first phase. And once I got that, I was very consistently clearing him, but it took a while for it all to kind of click. And once it did, that was it. There wasn't like that weird ramp up phase of like, okay, I'm doing okay, but I'm not perfect. It went from 0 to 100 right away because I got it. And that's what this kind of design lets them do.
Yeah.
And but I think that's where this game shines.
I agree with that. But at the same time, it does give you an off ramp in the form of Maria. Like that,
it does.
Mm-hmm. You know, the which, of course, other Castlevania games didn't necessarily do. You know,
yeah. I mean, and
is it time
on the fly
to talk
well.
About the 75-pound princess in the room here? Because
yeah, well, I was just surprised that you could actually just switch back and forth whenever you wanted.
Yeah,
really.
And here's the thing: you can totally miss Maria. It's super easy to miss Maria, in fact, because you get a power up key, and if you pick up another power up, guess what? You ain't getting Maria.
Yeah, I just did it because I was curious. I was like, okay, this key must open something, and I know that down below here there's a locked door, so maybe I should just give it a try.
Yeah. And so. Like, then you get anime happening where Richter tells Maria to go home, and she just rants at him. Like, no, yep. I've got
no,
special
powers. You can tell, too. You're like, okay, this is where she's saying, I'm not just a girl, blah, blah, blah. Classic anime style.
It's also like just total, it seems totally Scrappy-Doo, but this is what happens if you let Scrappy-Doo splat them. He will splat them. He will splat the shit out of them. That's what you find out in this game.
Like Richter's laugh when she starts yelling at him is so amazing. It's so condescending. Ha 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 ha. But then you get Maria. And the first time you play as Maria, there's this moment of, oh no.
Well, for me, it was like, oh my god, she can do that too? And that, I'm like, why the hell would I ever go back to Richter?
Yeah, but that's past like the initial shock of just like her existing in the game. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I was playing and Karen was watching me play and she was saying like, oh, I like this game. You know, I like watching you play because like it's colorful and it's just like it reminds me of the games that I watched my brother play when I was a kid. And then I show her Maria and she's just like, what the fuck? What is this? What's going on? And it's the most ridiculous thing, you know? I mean, I know that the game was, you know, wall chicken and stuff like that. Castlevania never really took itself seriously, but, you know, now you add the sundaes and cake and you know,
giant
doves
cakes
in the mix. Giant cake, yeah. And it's, I don't know. They really took the craziness of the series to 11.
Yeah, this is as Greg, you define them, silly Konami.
Yes, like, exactly. The parodious Konami, the going on Konami, like that. And I do love that part of it. And again, this is a really interesting way of kind of balancing because, like, is a like probably you know the best sort of meticulously crafted classic Castlevania game in here, and then there's the parodious Castlevania equivalent in the same
completely.
Game.
Yep.
Like, right. The game's just broken, but also like there's an extended sequence of her running down the stairs with like a dragon and a sheep and all kinds of shit just following behind her. Yeah. Like it's the stupidest get. Like here's this 12-year-old scolding Dracula who just seems bemused by the whole event.
He's like, yeah, that is really funny. It's just like, oh, but am I so bad? Isn't it all people that are bad? Bad. But that's it. She's basically just like, in the end, you're just bad, so fuck off. Like, that's pretty much it. That's fuck you and your moral relativism, Dracula.
So, yeah, so Greg,
I'm a little girl, I know what bad is.
So, yeah, you played it on PSP, so you had the translation, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, when you're playing on the Wii Virtual Console, it's just like, you've got nothing to go on.
Yeah,
you know, like
it starts
it's just
off in
just
German
the
and then moves into Japanese. It makes no sense.
Yeah, you can kind of piece it together from tone when Maria's talking or people are talking to Maria, but when it's Richter and Dracula, like, you lose a lot there. And it's funny that she, as a sounding board, allows you to pick up so much more because of the inflections and how they talk to her differently. And she does talk more simplistically than the other characters, so I'm actually picking up more of what she says. But, like, there's definitely more emotion there with all the characters interacting with her. But John, I want you to read Adadad's comment about Maria, because I think it describes what makes Maria so different as a character, besides just she's a 12-year-old girl who shoots dragons, whose icon is too big for the UI of the game.
Yeah, seriously. I'm not especially good at the game, so unlocking Maria early on was a godsend. I like how tongue-in-cheek finding Maria is. Her cute appearance and Richter's condescending attitude towards her are red herrings. She's a far more versatile and agile badass than Richter and has no obvious downsides. I'm not entirely sure, but I think her birds are slightly less powerful than Richter's whip, but that's easily made up for by the fact that she can shoot two at the same time and their flight arc is better. I can see myself playing through the first time predominantly as Maria and then perhaps switching to Richter for a replay. That's pretty much what I did. The only time when the game makes me feel like using Maria is a bit of a cop-out is on her game over screen with the cutesy font and flowers. That's totally true. Completely mocks you.
So I guess it's kind of like a prototype thing of Explosion Man giving you the 2-2, or what was it, Explosion Man? Which game was it? 2-2, it's a little bit of that about it, I guess.
Yeah, my reaction to that when I first saw it was, come on, really? Really, you have to put
the
up there?
The A in Game Over is slightly tilted in bubble letters. Oh, it's good. It's so cute. Yep. Flower borders. It's really funny.
Yeah, he said, okay, still, I think it was good of Konami to include her because Richter is so stiff. It's totally true. Attacking with Richter's rip reminds me a bit of the sword play in Zelda 2. Something about having to think carefully about whether you're ducking or standing.
Yep, and we've sort of touched on that.
Mm-hmm.
I like Maria as a character because Maria is such a ridiculous addition to the franchise. Maria also sticks around for the franchise for like three more games after this, but... Mm-hmm. There is just something about how she plays. So when he talked about her having a better range on her attacks, her attacks arc up and then come back.
Well, that's exactly it. And the birds, if you go the other way, the birds trail behind you, so you can actually kill stuff as you're running away from it.
Yeah.
Right. So unlike Richter's, where you have to actually hit the target, or basically perfect pixel from a vertical standpoint, she actually has upward and effectively downward trajectory, so she actually hits kind of in a fan pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And she can spam them, and they come out faster, and she has a double jump, and she has a ground slide, and she has better air control. It's like, she really is just a game-breaking... She's basically, you've Game Genie'd up a character.
Yeah.
she's kind of nuts, and it's really fun to have her in the game and get to play with her and I would say
an important thing about this game as well is the fact that I mean what Adadad talks about, I'm sure, is the kind of thing that a lot of people do in terms of you could kind of learn the game with the training wheels on a little bit or certain parts of it with Maria and then come back with Richter. But also, you know, Guillaume spoke about the 100% file thing. So this is a game with secrets. It's not just about getting to the end,
totally
killing Dracula. You've got a whole other branch of levels, the ones that have two prime, three prime, four prime, and five prime.
And five prime is god awful.
Yeah, five prime is we ran out of time. I assume
it's the worst level in any game I've ever played.
I assume on CD, the fact that it was on CD, they didn't run out of space. They ran out of time. And
five
it's just
prime
this,
is a nightmare.
This random salad of assets repurposed from other levels. Like, it starts out with the ghost ship, and then it's the bit before you fight Shaft, and then it's all over the shop. And there's no boss. You just fight a couple of great armors in the middle. It's all over the place. They really, one of the things about the PSP remake, not just playing the original game nested within the PSP remake, is that they completely make that its own level. They give it it's an aqueduct sort of setting, and then you go underground and you got different paths, and it still retains some core layout elements from that very weirdly pieced together five prime, but you get a unique snake boss at the end of it as well. It's actually a pretty decent level in that. And the other thing that the PSP remake does that we sort of deficiency addresses that we've already talked about is the Dracula final battle. It has a sort of hidden form if you actually do the requirements to rescue Richter's girlfriend, which requires you, I think, to rescue the other maidens first in that version, which then takes the final battle to another level. And it's a really quite cool, bringing down crazy blood rain attacks and turning into a wolf. And, you know, like, it's so much more interesting and challenging and fun. It really tops off the game, you know, those two additions. There's things about the PSP remake I'm not that fond of, because it does drain a lot of the color out of the game, and the polygonal graphics don't do that much for me. And it doesn't quite feel as tight, but those elements kind of do make it, if you're a really big fan of this game like I am, did actually make me feel, I mean, I bought it when it was on sale. It didn't cost me a lot, but it still felt worth it, even though I'd played the game a bunch before that.
My favorite secret area doesn't really lead anywhere. It's just like this cool idea that the designers had, and it's funny as hell. And they just put in the game because they could. There's this area where you're climbing, and you know, the series of slopes, and there's these fleamen riding kind of like metal balls.
Cannonballs.
Yeah, so you have to you know, avoid them, kill the fleamen, and just climb your way up. And then if you go to where they originate, you actually see kind of like this minotaur creature loading them off the dumbwaiter and just like, you know, like pushing them towards where you were. And so this minotaur, like, it's not even like, you can't kill it, you can't touch it, it's just kind of a background element, but you can write down the dumbwaiter all the way down. And what you find down is the same fleaman riding the same cannonballs, and they're just rolling back onto the dumbwaiter, so that they can, you know, climb back up and be picked up and be rolled down again. Like, this whole system doesn't make it.
HR at Dracula's Castle? Yeah. What is going on?
Seriously, yeah, like, I was wondering what the heck the point of that was. The only thing down there is a free life down there.
Yeah, there is, and there is, like, kind of an explanation. Like, I don't know, an explanation for something you didn't even need.
It's an Easter egg.
You didn't even know. Yeah, you didn't even know you wanted to know, right? Like, okay, like, where are these guys going?
There's a number of secrets and a bit like that. Have you seen the one, the ghost ship? Where the ghost ship has
the engine
in it.
It has a modern-ass outboard motor on inside, a big turbine engine.
Yeah.
Like, inside this ghost ship that's already supposed to be super old in the 1700s.
And floating around inside the castle walls, let's not forget. It's not going anywhere. It's so weird. And it's, I thought that's just got a life in it. That's all the stuff. That's so strange. There's a lot of cute attention to detail there. But, I mean, with the secrets that I wanted to say is, if you feel like you want to go back to a level, because you can, you know, once you've, there's a level select and you can pick from all the levels you've found before, to go back to, Maria's good for poking around. You know, to get, you know, it's like, well, now I don't have to be so methodical about, you know, going through all the different bits of the level when, you know, I've beaten this before. That's not the point. I just want to investigate. Yeah, you know, Maria's pretty cool for that, you know, because she makes it faster. She make, you know, it's a good, the point I made. You know, this is, you know, kind of
your reward.
Foreshadows where they were. If foreshadows where they were going to go with the series, you know, this kind of character, you know, Alucard is a hell of a lot more like Maria than he is like Richter. You know, the reason for that is because when you're exploring, as I've said many times, you know, you want a character that feels good to explore with. You don't want Simon Belmont in Simon's Quest. You know, that's not a good idea.
With his foot shuffle?
So, yeah. And so, yeah, when you're playing that aspect of the
game. What a horrible night for a curse to pop up while you're exploring.
When you play, and in this game, even though it's, you know, mostly linear, you know, there are elements of poking around for the alternate paths. You know, there's alternate exits to stages. They'll take you to different bosses. They'll take you to all different stages. As we said, that sort of second path to the game and all that. You know, if you're just trying to find those things out, then, you know, it's a lot quicker and more sort of liberating to do that with Maria. So even if you're a kind of advanced player, you know, she's more than just an easy mode to me. There is an actual, kind of guilt. There is a reward element too of, like, you know, this is something I could use to my advantage. Kind of like one of those, like, ridiculous weapons you might get in a Castlevania, you know, sort of Symphony of the Night style game, where it just means you can kill everything at will and move around the castle unencumbered.
So I wanted to, before we wrap up, just include a comment that we have from Clex Yoshi. And Greg, I'm going to have you start with the second paragraph before we go into it. I want to say that in the chat last night, he got me into the bonus stages, which I was aware of but could not figure out how to get. Walked me through understanding Richter's jumping and just seems to be generally an expert on the Castlevania series in a little bit of like a, wow, you've played a lot of these games, man, kind of way. And
he's
thought on Maria versus Richter to a certain degree that I kind of wanted to go into.
It's a good one, this. So Klexius says, I could see how opinions like John's that he posted on Twitter are valid. I would have to consult
John.
With Twitter.
Yeah, for some background there, pretty much I was just complaining that this game was, it occupies kind of a weird space for me because I really, really like it. Like, I play through it, I'm like, man, this is so cool. But after about an hour, I'm just like, man, I'm sick of this game's bullshit. I'm just sick of it. And I'll come back to it and I'll enjoy it. But then at a certain point, I'm just like, you know, I'll die for like the third time in a row or like get killed on a boss just because I don't know this pattern or that pattern. I'm just like, man, I just need to put this down and come back to it. So.
I think that's fair. I remember when I was a kid, trying to beat Dracula over and over and over again, I probably would have been better served by coming back to it, but they didn't have the save feature, so it's their fault.
yes.
You know, it was designed for a save, that's very clear. Anyway, so yeah, that's what Eclexioshi's referring to. But he said, I jokingly liken this to my friend's excuse on why he thinks it sucks to have steamed crab legs for dinner.
Yeah, yeah. I said, basically, that the work that I need to put in is not worth the entertainment.
Okay, so I get the point. It's a lot of work figuring out the best ways to crack those shells in the best way possible, or pull the tendons out just right to get the meat out in the most intact shape you can.
Very visceral email.
When you do crack the shell, there's not a whole lot of meat there to dunk in your melted butter. I feel that when crab is good and steam dry, it's one of the finest meals you can have. No, there isn't a lot of meat there, but what is there is oh so succulent. If Rondo of Blood with Richter is like trying to break into King Crab, though, Maria is like getting that imitation crab meat out of a vacuum package. Yeah, it's crab-like, and it's instant in its gratification, but even if you like it, you know there's some indignity and something you're missing out on by not having your crab freshly steamed.
Wow, that's an extended crab legs metaphor that I was not anticipating.
You could just kind of go to the thing of like, well, food tastes nicer when you cooked it. Like, when you put work into it, it's somehow more satisfying.
I put the work in it to earn the money to pay someone else to cook it. That's fine.
I think that the problem is that's evidently just not visceral enough for some people to feel rewarding.
But that's really like that's going to appeal to a certain type of person,
sure.
Right? Like, yeah. I mean, and I think I used to be that way, and recently I kind of I can't really bother anymore. Like, during the Wii era.
You aged out of that.
Well, yeah, I think so. Like, I mean, during the Wii era, like, that's when I played through, like, Ninja Gaiden and Castlevania for the first time, and I really enjoyed it, and I can't see myself doing that today. I just, I did not even finish, like, I did not beat Dracula this time around on Rondo of Blood. I'm sorry.
I think it speaks to the design of this game that it can appeal to two very distinct. Yes, that it can appeal to two very extremely distinct playstyles here. Like, it's a kind of a proto super guide in a way. Like, there's this like, if you just want to get through the game and see all the silly stuff the game has to offer, and see the 95 foot tall Frankenstein you're gonna fight somewhere, and
the bat is like enormous.
And then kill Dracula and then reprimand him. Maria's there for you. Or even if you want to play it like I do, which is if I die. Two continues on Richter, and unless I feel like I'm really getting there, it's Maria time.
The ripcord.
Like,
It is the Maria ripcord, absolutely.
Yeah. But there is, like, you can be the I want to get perfect with this game. I want to really get in there and really understand how to play and perfect Richter playstyle. And that's there for you because the game is so well designed around Richter.
No, it really is.
But if you just want to get through there and play the game, Maria is still really fun to play as.
And to some extent, I mean, I think, you know, this is where the Super Nintendo Dracula X is a little bit instructive, because, you know, it's very similar in a number of ways. It doesn't have Maria, even though it needs her more.
Yeah. You know, because it's harder. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. But mainly because, you know, Richter is pretty much, you know, this, as I said, the mechanics, all that stuff is pretty much the same. But the level design is not as well to sort of crafted around his moveset in that game. Even though it's borrowing a lot from Rondo in terms of layouts, in terms of the enemies and everything, it's just not as well designed. You know, it's such a weird thing. It's not really a port. It's not really, you can't really say it's a remake. It's just this alternate version that's not nearly as good. It's a weird, weird game.
And missing a core feature, ultimately.
But having been able to play that on the Wii U Virtual Console for the first time after having played Rondo Blood, it did have the sort of, I mean, you know, it's not terrible, terrible. You know, there's a little bit of that pizza thing of, you know, sort of even bad pizza still enjoyable, perhaps, because I do really, really love Castlevania games of that vintage. But, I mean, there's a few very weird decisions. Like, Rondo seems to have made, to my eyes anyway, made the invincibility time after you get hurt shorter than in some of the other Castlevanias.
Oh, yes.
And then
absolutely.
Super Nintendo Dracula says, let's make it shorter again. Why would you do that? It's so strange.
It's already so short that the bat with swords will hit you twice sometimes. Like,
yeah, but it's, I don't, again, I can only imagine that was some weird thing of, you know, that there was in that particular point in time. There was a move to try and make games, you know, that were headed for the Western market harder because of the you know, rentals were not allowed in Japan, but they were a big deal in America, and the fear that you could lose sales if people could easily beat your game on a rental. Maybe that factored into that, or maybe it was just a very, to my eyes, it just seemed like a really low budget project to get a Castlevania game out on Super Nintendo, you know, after 4. And, you know, they did it by repurposing a bunch of stuff from this game that had never come to America before and just did it in a quite a sloppy way. That would be my impression. And certainly the way they try to address the issue of the last boss being too easy, and it's certainly not too easy, but it is infamous with the sort of just you fighting on this series of pillars. So it's just the instant death pits everywhere.
Is the ultimate fuck you in boss design.
I have beaten that boss straight up, and it's not particularly fun, I shall say that. But, I mean, one thing I want to mention as well about some of these secrets as well is that there's even, and this is something you don't see that much in even the exploration-based cafes, there's even a little bit of environmental puzzle solving going on.
Yep.
You know, like, you cut in the... That there's that boulder that you could kind of cut off, and then it sort of flings you up a lift to an extra boss encounter, and that kind of
drop the spike balls from the level up and drop them down to
exactly, you know, like it's
stepping
it's
on things and, you know.
Yeah, there's like there's the dungeon level which has a whole bunch of like booby trap switches and stuff like just a more. I mean, you talked about like the little bits of world building with the flea man parade or what, but you know, there's also just the environment feels more
connected,
connected and whole and interactive and all this stuff, and sometimes that actually will take you to different bosses at different levels, which is really, really cool. The only reservation I have about all that is sometimes, like, you know, this is a game with bottomless pits, death pits, and then sometimes there's something down that pit.
Yeah.
You know,
like, I'm dead. Not, yeah. What the hell? Wait a minute. But then you just die anyways because you're screwed.
But that's also straight up Mega Man X stuff. Like, Mega Man X is like, is this pit okay to slide down? Let's find... Oh, I died.
I mean, it's interesting because Shantae and the Pirate's Curse on 3DS that I played, you know, it kind of addresses that a bit. When there is a pit that is actually bottomless, it has those skull and crossbones sort of mist coming up from it. So, you know... That is a pit that will kill you.
Yeah.
Right.
And then if you see one that isn't like that, well, then you can poke around at the bottom of it. I mean, yeah, that's a bit, maybe a bit more overt than I'd like, but I would like if it's not necessarily the most intuitive all the time about what pits. I mean, there's some that you kind of, take a look at and think, yeah, you know, I'll chance it. I'll have a go down there. And then there's others that you could easily play through the level multiple times and never think that that's somewhere that, you know, you would go and stay alive. But it does kind of make discovering them even more kind of special when you do.
Yeah. So I think we need to wrap up. Does anybody have any quick thoughts they want to put out on this game?
I liked it a lot. I have yet to play through it, but it you know, despite my kind of love hate, it really hit all the right notes in terms of Castlevania. It really, I mean, it strikes me. If I would have played this at the time it came out, I would have absolutely fallen in love with it because it really is a bridge title between Castlevania 4 and Symphony of the Night, which are two of my most favorite games ever. And it's the right amount of kind of cartoony, garish sort of artwork, but still very gothic and dark at the same time. I really like the way it kind of mixes that. It's very arcadey, but at the same time, it has just like a lot of cool satanic kind of evil stuff in it. Like it's
you got your pentagram,
yeah,
spinning around, and
yeah. So it was really cool. Like I'm definitely gonna play it all the way through. That's for sure.
Yeah,
I really enjoy it because it does have like the whole alternate exit thing that unlocks alternate stages is just one of my favorite things about like 90s era games. You know, Demon's Crest does that, and it's one of my favorite games of all time. And Rondo of Blood does it, and before that, Castlevania 3 did it, but this game is so much more forgiving, especially with the saves and the ability to go back to certain levels, and of course Maria and all of that, and the enhanced controls. So yeah, it might be my favorite kind of classic Castlevania. For whatever reason, like the Super Castlevania 4 never really stuck with me. Like there's a few levels in it that really frustrate me, and this, I don't know. I really like the, everything that we've discussed, you know, the connectedness of the levels, kind of the sense of place, the little Easter eggs and stuff like that. It's just, it's a great game.
Yep.
I really like it. Like I said, I would have to say, I think it is the best classic Castlevania style game. And that is, you know, was a tough distinction for it to earn because it didn't have the childlike affection that I had for 1 and 4 and things like that. So, you know, it had a lot of, and it had the burden of expectation, you know, years of wanting to play and then finally getting to do it. You know, it's had a lot of pressure on it and it all withstood all of that. So I think it really does speak to its quality. You know, and, God, you know, it's just, you know, I mean, I guess there's a little bit of, there's a little bit of some of the same satisfaction in Castlevania, The Adventure Rebirth, even though it's like quite a lot more limited because those games were really quite small. But, you know, even though it's strictly linear, it does have like the key thing again and stuff. You know, so you've got secret bits of the level that you can get in that'll just give you more like points or lives and stuff. But I feel like this is just such a sweet spot balance for classic Castlevania. It's such a shame that we never got anything that quite hit it the same way again. But I guess it was not so much a victim of its own success, but a victim of the success of its successor. You know,
yes.
That's pretty much put paid to it, sadly.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to do it for our retroactive on Castlevania Rondo of Blood. This is probably the first retroactive in a while. We've all come out being really positive on the game, like really enjoyed our time with it.
Joe. I thought we all enjoyed
that's
that.
That's true. I think Beautiful
Joe. I mean, immediately
had
to end it on a sour note with the new metal thing. You know, there was no need for that,
yeah,
wasn't it?
But, sorry.
But, yeah, still.
I think Beautiful Joe, that there was a little bit more like, yeah, well, you know. Like, this game, I'm really surprised how much I enjoyed this game. It just sounds like it was an overall really cool experience. And I hope that if you didn't play along with us, you go give this game a try. Because to Greg's point, it's kind of one of a kind. So, Greg, I'm going to let you pick which song of the ones you sent you want to use for the end theme.
Okay, well, maybe we'll go with the Dracula X Tango version of Bloodlines.
Okay.
Because it's one of the good things that came out of that game. And, you know, it still is born of the theme that was created for Rondo Blood. So it's there.
Fair enough. And on that, it's time to end the show. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Later.